House Interim Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Good morning, colleagues. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We have a full agenda today. And let's go ahead and get started. I'll open an informational meeting on the Clean Fuels Program. Call up Paul Garahan and Brian Doherty, please. Mr. Garahan.
Good morning, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. I'm Paul Garahan. I'm the Assistant Attorney in Charge of the Natural Resources Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here this morning to describe a decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the United States Federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision regarding a challenge to California's low-carbon fuel standards. This decision was made in September of this year. There are two key points, and this decision is relevant because, of course, the legislature in 2009 authorized the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt low-carbon fuel standards here in Oregon. The EQC has adopted a first phase of those standards requiring registration of fuel producers and suppliers and motor vehicle fuel producers and suppliers, and has not adopted sort of the requirement stage, phase two of that program yet, and because the authorization in 2009 included a 2015 sunset, and so the decision was made that the EQC would not, at the time it was considering the program, would not adopt the full program because the sunset was coming quickly. And so that issue, of course, is before the legislature, or maybe before the legislature was in the last session, about whether or not to lift the sunset that removes the EQC's authority to adopt and implement that program at the end of 2015. So that's why this issue is relevant. There were challenges to California's program alleging that it violated the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And there are two points that I would like to leave you with in my presentation today to summarize very briefly. The first is that the Ninth Circuit, the district court, had held that California's low-carbon fuel standards violated the Commerce Clause and was unconstitutional in a few different respects. And the Ninth Circuit overruled the district court's decision on each of those points where the district court had ruled that the California standards were unconstitutional. The second point is there have been some assertions that a certain statements in the Ninth Circuit's opinion held that other states were preempted from adopting their own standards, and that is not what the Ninth Circuit held on that issue, and that issue has not been decided yet, whether or not under the Clean Air Act other states are preempted. So I'll give a little bit of background to start, and I'll try to keep this as direct as possible here, because it involves a long history of Supreme Court decisions setting precedents on interpreting the Commerce Clause, and I'll try to keep it as direct and straightforward as I can. A little bit of background on the Commerce Clause and how the Supreme Court has interpreted the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and then a little bit of background on California's low-carbon fuel standards to set up what the Ninth Circuit held. The Commerce Clause is a grant of power to Congress to regulate commerce between the states, to regulate interstate commerce. It's been interpreted by the Supreme Court in what's been referred to as the negative or dormant Commerce Clause to also mean that states can't unjustifiably discriminate against interstate commerce, even when Congress has not acted. And so it essentially prohibits economic protectionism One state can't favor its own in-state business to the detriment of out-of-state business. It can't discriminate on for no reason other than it's trying to promote its own in-state business at the expense of out-of-state business. So the way that the Commerce Clause has been interpreted by the Supreme Court, there's a series of analyses that the court goes through to determine whether or not a regulation or a law is unconstitutional in violation of the Commerce Clause. First, it looks at the law or regulation on its face and says, just on the face, the language on the face, is it unjustifiably favoring in-state versus out-of-state? The second level of analysis is, does it discriminate in purpose or effect? So its language might not on its face discriminate, but it still might have the purpose and effect of discriminating. In either of those two cases, the court applies what's been referred to as strict scrutiny. Essentially, unless the state can show, well, the state always has to show it, that its law or regulation is in support of a legitimate purpose that's within its authority. And then the second analysis, when the court's applying the strict scrutiny, is there any other non-discriminatory way to achieve the same policy? And if there is, then the court holds that the regulation is unconstitutional. The reality is that when strict scrutiny is applied, it almost always means that the court will hold that the law or regulation is unconstitutional, because there is almost always a non-discriminatory alternative way to try to get at the same policy aim. If a law or regulation affects interstate commerce and has impacts on interstate commerce, but the court finds it does not discriminate either on its face or in purpose and effect, then the court just balances, are the benefits of the law or regulation, do they outweigh the burdens on interstate commerce? It's a simple balancing, one against the other. And the reality, when the court provides the balancing test, is that the law or regulations usually are held to be constitutional. They usually are able to meet that balancing. So really it comes down to this question, is it facial discrimination or does it discriminate in purpose and effect? If it doesn't, then the law is usually held constitutional. If it does, the law is usually held unconstitutional. And then there's a corollary piece that's involved here in the Supreme Court precedent, that states can't through their law try to control conduct of other states, than that conduct that's happening in other states. It's called extraterritorial regulation or control. And there were assertions that the California program was trying to control actions outside its borders. So that's a little bit of background. I'll come back to that when I talk about the Ninth Circuit's decision. A little background on California's low carbon fuel standard. Many of you may have already, you know, received some briefings on the concept of the low carbon fuel standard and understand this. The California's program, it assigns a carbon intensity based on the total life cycle carbon used to bring a motor vehicle fuel to market and for it to be used. It considers the carbon involved in producing the fuel, and for oil, for example, that includes the cost to extract it and refine it, transporting the crude oil to a refinery, transporting the refined gasoline to market. For ethanol, an alternative, for example, that includes all the carbon it would take, and most ethanol is created from corn, so it includes all of the carbon involved in growing the corn, in transporting the corn to a production facility, and then transporting that finished ethanol product to the market, and then using it again. The concept establishes carbon intensity requirements And if a fuel has more carbon, based on this life cycle analysis, if it's given a higher carbon, total life cycle carbon score than the requirement, then it has to make up the difference with credits. If a fuel is below the requirement, so the alternative fuels with less carbon are below that required level, they earn credits. And so it sets up a credit, a debit and credit trading system where they can be bought and sold, and creates incentives for the alternative fuels. The way the program works is in California is that it established default carbon intensity values. Instead of making every single fuel provider go through an analysis, a detailed analysis of precisely what the carbon content of their fuel is, it set up some default assumptions for different types of fuel because different fuels similarly situated with the same production processes, same inputs, same locations of production, so same energy used to produce the fuel. If those factors are all the same, then all of the different producers within those areas would have, that fuel would have the same basic carbon intensity. So instead of making everyone go through the process of setting their own and proving their own carbon intensity, the program sets default values. It simplifies compliance. And it's set basically for ethanol, it set three regional pathways with these default values. One for California ethanol, one for Midwest-based ethanol, and one for ethanol from Brazil, which is another one of the largest suppliers of ethanol in the California market. And there is an option, however, in order to ensure that if any producer or supplier thinks that their carbon intensity is lower than that default value, they have the option of going through their own process to prove that they should be given a lower carbon intensity score. So that's the basic setup and concept of California's program. And it was challenged as being a violation of the Commerce Clause, of this negative Commerce Clause, on the ethanol grounds primarily because of this different treatment where the California ethanol default score was a lower score than the Midwest ethanol default score. And so it was challenged saying, on its face, that's discriminating against the out-of-state producers. And the district court in December of 2011 held that it was unconstitutional, and there were three reasons for its holding and why it applied strict scrutiny. First is that on the ethanol issue, it held that that was facially discriminatory, that there was not a justifiable reason to treat that out-of-state ethanol differently. Secondly, it ruled that the program impermissibly engaged in extraterritorial regulation of ethanol production outside the state. Third, the district court held that some of the crude oil scoring provisions in the law discriminated in purpose and effect. So the ethanol rules it held discriminated on their face, the crude oil in purpose and effect. In either of those cases, again, strict scrutiny applied. And the court held it was unconstitutional. There was a fourth piece to the district court's holding also that's relevant here, and that is that California argued, California under the Clean Air Act, a little more background here, California under the Clean Air Act has always held sort of a special place because when the Clean Air Act was originally passed, California had already started to adopt laws to improve air quality in California, especially laws dealing with motor vehicles. And so California has always had sort of a carve-out in the Clean Air Act that allowed it to go ahead and adopt its own rules. So, for example, that's why you might have heard about motor vehicle standards, production standards. There's the California standard, and then there's the federal standard. And instead of being preempted, California gets to adopt that standard. And the Clean Air Act in those provisions allows other states to adopt California's standard if they choose to. So there can be two standards for sort of fuel economy issues of motor vehicles. There are other similar waivers in the Clean Air Act. And one of those waivers is that for any laws related to the content or characteristics of motor vehicle fuels. If the EPA adopts regulations, other states are preempted. Or if it decides regulations aren't necessary on a specific type of regulation of a characteristic of fuel or a component of fuel, if the EPA acts, other states are preempted from acting, except for California. Now, under the Commerce Clause, again, it grants authority to Congress to regulate commerce, interstate commerce. And it's been interpreted in some cases, Congress can act to authorize states to regulate interstate commerce. And essentially, in those limited areas, that state then gets a waiver from Commerce Clause compliance. And California was arguing that its waiver from this provision in the Clean Air Act regarding whether it could regulate fuel acted as that kind of special waiver under the Commerce Clause, that in essence Congress had acted to say, California, on these fuel issues, you can regulate interstate commerce. Now, in order for a law to be interpreted as essentially giving a state a pass on Commerce Clause compliance, the court has said Congress has to act very specifically. So California was trying to cite this exception that it gets under this provision of the Clean Air Act as a demonstration of Congress authorizing it to regulate interstate commerce. And the court said, no, California, it's not clear enough. So you still have to prove that your standard here complies with the Commerce Clause. So this issue comes back up because the Ninth Circuit ruled on that issue as well. So that's the district court's decision. Now we move to the Ninth Circuit, which issued its opinion in September of this year, 2013. The Ninth Circuit, as I said before, overturned all of the district court's holdings that the California standards were unconstitutional. The outline I've provided you goes into some of the key points on each of those three items. But the quick summary is, on the ethanol provision, the court ruled that they do not facially discriminate. That, in essence, there are justifiable reasons related specifically to the amount of actual carbon that it takes to produce the fuel that justify the differences in how Midwest fuel is treated from California ethanol. So it doesn't facially discriminate. Now, I'll note on that issue, the district court, because it had determined on those ethanol provisions that they facially discriminated, it didn't rule on whether or not they discriminated in purpose and effect. So the Ninth Circuit, essentially, the district court stopped its analysis because it said facial discrimination. So the Ninth Circuit has not said the ethanol provisions are constitutional forevermore. It said, district court, you got it wrong on the facial discrimination issue. So that issue, the Ninth Circuit has sent back to the district court. Now the district court has to analyze whether that provision discriminates in purpose and effect, and it would still apply strict scrutiny, or if there are just impacts on interstate commerce and it applies that balancing test. And then once the district court makes that decision, if anyone appeals, it might go back to the Ninth Circuit. But that issue is still live and will be back at the district court. The Ninth Circuit also held that this was not an extraterritorial regulation, that in essence it regulates only the California fuel market, that individual business choice about whether to participate in that California market is still present, and no other state is required to adopt any rules to comply with California's program. It's a matter of choice of the businesses on whether they want to meet those requirements in order to sell their fuel in California. Third, the Ninth Circuit held that on some of the crude oil provisions, they do not discriminate in purpose or effect. And so there were some arguments about some of those crude oil scoring of where different crude oil from different sources, that those were also favoring California. The court held that California sources were not always favored and that there were legitimate purposes for the differences in how those crude oil, the different sources of crude oil fuel-based fuel were provided. And then fourth, the Ninth Circuit agreed with the district court that California didn't get a special waiver from Commerce Clause compliance. Now that's the issue that I think is part of the reason that there was interest in talking more about this Ninth Circuit decision, because there's there have been assertions that the Ninth Circuit's decision in that respect held that other states were preempted from adopting their own standards. I note in the copy of an outline of my testimony that I provided to you, the last two pages labeled Attachment A and Attachment B. Attachment A is a quote of, it's the full text of this provision of the Clean Air Act, and there's some underlining emphasis there. And then Attachment B is the Ninth Circuit's full treatment of this one issue. In the Ninth Circuit's 71 pages of the opinion of the court, these two paragraphs are the entire treatment of this issue on preemption and whether California gets this special waiver from Commerce Clause compliance. And the key point is that the provision, if you look at Attachment A, the provision in the Clean Air Act says, no state may prescribe or attempt to enforce any control or prohibition respecting any characteristic or component of a fuel or fuel additive if, and these are the little I and little 2i in the middle of the page, if the administrator has found no control is necessary and has published his finding in the Federal Register, or if the administrator has prescribed a control regarding that particular characteristic or component of fuel. So the only time that other states are preempted are if EPA has made a finding that no regulation of this kind is necessary and has published it in the Federal Register, or if they've prescribed their own requirement relating this component or characteristic. And neither of those actions have occurred. The EPA has not adopted national low-carbon fuel standards or carbon content requirements, and they haven't published any finding that none is necessary. So this section doesn't come into play yet. Subsection B at the bottom there, that's California's special exception from this preemption provision. So even if there were federal standards or there was a federal finding that no standards were necessary, California, it doesn't say California, but the references there are to only apply to California. California can still go ahead and adopt their own standards. And so this is where California seized onto this last point and said, that gives us a special waiver under the Commerce Clause. And the court didn't need to decide whether or not other states were preempted. That issue wasn't before them because, in fact, no other states were parties to the case. It was only a case between California and these other private entities alleging that California's standards weren't constitutional. And so, excuse me, the court could not have decided because the issue simply was not presented before. So, and, you know, there have been some assertions that, well, and in fact, I'll go, and it is true that the court, if you look at Attachment B, the beginning of the second paragraph quoting the court's opinion, they include a quote of the Clean Air Act that says, essentially, that first part of the preemption provision of the Act that says other states are preempted. It doesn't cite the two ifs that are key to when that preemption kicks in. And the reason it doesn't is because the court didn't need to decide that. California was just trying to claim this special place, and the court didn't even need to get there. I hesitate a little bit to oversimplify it, but I was trying to think of a good analogy to make here, and the one I thought of was if a baseball player hit a hit and it went in the gap and rolled all the way to the fence, and the baseball player tried to stretch a double into a triple and was thrown out by 10 steps, and the umpire called the player out at third base. This argument is an argument that whether or not the player touched first base has to be decided first. So maybe there's a question, and maybe if the player had been safe, they could have appealed and gone back because the player, the base runner, forgot to touch first base. That issue isn't really relevant, though, because the player was out by so much. The umpire doesn't say, nope, we have to go back, you have to appeal, and you have to get him out at first base first. The issue would never come in front of the umpire at that point, never be asked, because they don't have to decide it. The player was out at third base. Now, the other key part here, of course, is that the people arguing about this aren't even the players in the game. They're spectators. They're on the sideline watching the game and having a fight over whether the runner touched first base. So that's my analogy here. And the issue about preemption was not decided by the Ninth Circuit. It didn't need to decide that issue. So now the current status of the case, to bring you to the present, the plaintiffs have requested what's called en banc rehearing. So the Ninth Circuit, this was a panel, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit that issued this decision in September. And now the plaintiffs have requested the entire Ninth Circuit, all of the judges that sit on the Ninth Circuit, to rehear this case in front of every one of them. And so the Ninth Circuit is considering that request. And we're waiting to hear whether the decision is to rehear the case in front of the full court. If that request is denied, then the plaintiffs could file a petition for certiorari with the United States Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to review the case. And then the Supreme Court will decide whether or not to hear the case. Absent a successful appeal in either of those ways, then, as I said, the case will go back to the district court. And there are a couple pieces they still need to decide. First, as I said, on the ethanol provisions, do they discriminate in purpose or effect? And then on the crude oil provisions, they have to apply that balancing test, as I said before, because they found on crude oil that they did not discriminate in purpose or effect. So there's still some constitutional decisions that will be argued and will need to be made back at the district court again. And then, as I said, those decisions could be appealed back again to the Ninth Circuit. So the summary here is, at this point, the Ninth Circuit overturned all the district court's conclusions that the California standards were unconstitutional. And the court also did not hold that other states were preempted from adopting their own standards. Thank you.
Thank you. It was very thorough and very helpful. We appreciate your time on that. Mr. Doherty, your perspective, please.
Yes. Brian Doherty on behalf of Miller Nash, testifying here on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. I know you're shocked to find that two Irishmen could possibly disagree, but we probably do on a very narrow issue here. There's really two things here, constitutionality of the LCFS and the preemption exemption issue. To be brief, my phrase would be, you don't get exemption if you don't go through preemption. And that's what the case was at in terms of the issue of whether other states can adopt this. The constitutionality of the California LCFS has not been decided, as I agree with Mr. Garahan's factual history. What the district court found was that on its face in the original summary judgment motions, it was unconstitutional. One of the three appellate judges agreed that it's unconstitutional. The other two majority found that it was, that his reasons, the preliminary reasons, they disagreed with and remanded back and said, do your further Commerce Clause analysis. So I look at it, it's 2-2. We have two judges that have found it this way and two judges that haven't. It's a complex case. Probably has over 40 attorneys in it, representing every side on this, amicus briefs and all. But I'd like to point out that the state of Oregon filed an amicus brief for a reason, and that's because the California attorneys were arguing that the Clean Air Act applies here, and that while other states are preempted, we have a specific exemption. And by getting that exemption, we are protected from Commerce Clause attacks. Both courts said, yes, your exemption's here, but you are not protected from Commerce Clause attacks. You have to defend those. So that's what happened there. And what we're saying is, in that language, the court very clearly said that the Clean Air Act preempts states from adopting these fuel standards, except California has a specific line item exemption. And that's the issue. Mr. Garahan disagrees. He does not think that the preemption provision was triggered. And I would say that you can divide up those 40 attorneys and probably half agree with him and half agree with us. And I think nothing has been litigated here because California has the first in the nation LCFS. Oregon has not adopted implementation of an LCFS, nor has any other state. So I imagine when the first state does do an implementation, this will be an issue. So my thoughts are, and I'd be glad to answer any of the questions you have on this, but my point is, and I think our legal conclusion is, that the Ninth Circuit, you had to get to preemption to say that they got their exemption, and therefore it's been triggered. I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure there are lots of questions. Mr. Doherty, I do have one quick question. You mentioned amicus briefs, and my understanding is that the Western States Petroleum Association filed an amicus brief in which there was a footnote that acknowledged that in order for preemption to occur, that the federal government would, that the EPA would have had to enact its own restrictions or decided that one was not needed. Do you think that that is still the case, or do you disagree with that WSPA?
I think that there is possibly that there has been a trigger in this case. You have a federal RFS. You have several things that are in place there. I think the courts are looking at this. The Ninth Circuit had to make a statement in there about preemption and exemption. The arguments on the amicus briefs were very different. And by the way, that was filed on behalf of the Oregon Petroleum Association, was a response to the state of Oregon's arguments that they don't apply. And it had many other issues in there. So it was not a direct hit there. And I think what we were saying in that is we're seeing what the Ninth Circuit said now. The Ninth Circuit said a lot of things that weren't briefed or were briefed on others, but I think the response, there was clearly a argument by the state of California about preemption exemption, and the state of Oregon was trying to say, whatever you do, don't preempt the other states. We think the Ninth Circuit reached that.
Questions for this panel?
Technical question on the ethanol provision, and you mentioned Brazilian ethanol. It seems like how much Brazilian ethanol did California use? Do you know as a percentage of the three?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, I don't recall. I know that the Ninth Circuit, I recollect the Ninth Circuit's opinion includes some statement. It was an amount of ethanol that surprised me what the number was. I want to say it's somewhere between 20% and 40% or something like that. It was a significant portion of the California market, but I don't know the number, so I may be wrong in that estimation.
It seems like it would have a significantly higher carbon intensity score based on the transportation of the ethanol from South America into California.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, you know, the court actually noted that very point because obviously the court was surprised about hearing about the facts of the case also. The interesting thing about ethanol and the carbon score is that the more important transportation component is the cost to transport the corn to the production facility. That, because the raw product corn is much heavier, much bulkier, that amount of transportation cost is much more significant. And the cost to transport finished ethanol by ship Shipping is one of the most efficient modes of transportation because it can carry, the ship can carry so much, and it doesn't actually take a lot of fuel. And so, surprisingly, the Brazilian ethanol score competes rather well, as the court described, with the ethanol from California. In some cases, I think it was actually the lowest carbon intensity score. I don't recall the specifics, but that natural inclination to think it would be higher turns out to not actually be the case.
Thanks.
Just briefly, Chair Bailey, Representative Whitson, there was a lot. First of all, Brazil doesn't make enough ethanol to even supply the California market. California is even bigger than that. Number two, California state court basically said that the LCFS was improperly promulgated, and the California Air Resources Board suspended its implementation program at 1% and isn't lowering it anymore. Midwest corn ethanol is able to meet that. So the demand for Brazilian is not as great as if they continue down. It is a lower carbon intensity number. And a big reason on this is indirect land use. I think Representative Bailey understands that concept. It has issues, but it is a big component as well. So I think that's still in flux, some of these numbers, but Brazilian sugarcane is lower.
Chair Bailey, if I may, I wanted to make one other point in response to Mr. Daugherty's, some of his comments here about the issue being briefed and arguments for preemption. We haven't even touched on a whole separate argument about preemption. There was an argument, he mentioned the Federal Renewable Fuel Standard, and there was an argument that under that standard, a separate provision of the Clean Air Act, that preempted this adoption. That was the issue and he's correct, and the state filed amicus briefs at both the district court and at the Ninth Circuit, so I want to be clear about that. And that was the issue at the Ninth Circuit that Oregon briefed, was whether or not California's standard was preempted by a separate standard. And the Ninth Circuit held on that issue, we express no opinion on plaintiff's claim that the fuel standard is preempted by the RFS, by the Renewable Fuel Standard. And the reason the court wasn't ruling on that is because the district court cited that as that the potential for that violation was a reason that the court had issued a preliminary injunction in the case to stop the standard initially. And it hadn't ruled on that issue, and in fact it never had finally ruled when the appeal came to the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit said, the district court actually hasn't ruled on this, and so we express no opinion. That was a whole separate preemption issue, not decided by the Ninth Circuit, and so that's why I didn't think in all of the other complicated issues here that was really relevant, but that was the issue that Oregon briefed in its amicus brief at the Ninth Circuit, not whether or not this other argument about preemption actually was going to end up in a Ninth Circuit holding that Oregon and other states were preempted, because again, that argument, the parties, that was not a relevant argument to the parties before the court in the case.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your time and your attention to this matter.
Thank you.
Okay, I've closed the informational meeting on the Clean Fuels Program. Open informational meeting on Invisible Enemies, Reducing Air Toxics in the Portland Airshed Report from the City Club of Portland. I'd like to call up Spencer Ehrman, Peter Livingston, and Maria Everhart, please. May proceed in whichever order you feel is best.
Good morning, Chair Bailey and representatives. Thank you for inviting us here this morning. I am Spencer Ehrman. This is Peter Livingston and Maria Everhart. At the beginning of last year, the City Club charged our committee with investigating air quality regulation in the Portland metropolitan area, and this report is the result. I believe you've been provided with an executive summary of our report, so we'll try and be brief in going through our presentation. We found that Portland's metro area endures toxic air pollutants at concentrations that negatively affect the public's overall health and increase the rate of disease. At least 52 air toxics are present in Oregon, and between 6 and 10 are at unhealthy concentrations in Portland. Air pollution control has developed along two pathways. One is for criteria pollutants, or smog, and one is for air toxics. Smog pollutants have steadily declined under orchestrated mandates by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. However, air toxics have not been sufficiently controlled or reduced for the Portland metropolitan area. Air quality reporting, air pollution advisories, and other existing alert systems don't measure or report levels of air toxics. In fact, only three monitoring stations in the state are capable of detecting air toxics, and now two are in the metropolitan area of Portland. The results are poorly publicized. As a result, many well-informed citizens, including ourselves, receive an incomplete and reassuring impression that we have conquered air pollution. The scientific community now understands how tiny exposures over time affect health. Roughly quantified, 180 more cases of cancer occur in the Portland metro area due to each of the toxics that are listed in the table in our report. We were surprised, and the sources of air toxics may surprise you as well. A comprehensive process conducted by an expert advisory committee of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality yielded a listing of source in priority order. Based on the research performed over the last 18 months, our committee refined that list to this priority order: residential wood-to-smoke combustion, cars, light trucks, heavy-duty diesel vehicles, non-road internal combustion engines, including construction equipment and generators, and industrial metals facilities. The industrial and commercial emissions permitting processes are subjected to ongoing public debate, policy proposals, news coverage, and regulatory enforcement. However, no federal, state, or metro area ambient standards exist for air toxics. As a result, it's difficult to know the concentration of toxics in our airshed. The five priority areas of the sources of air toxics encompass home, leisure, and work life, and different parts of the Portland airshed have different concentrations of each. Anti-pollution initiatives will require coordination between government agencies to change the behavior of thousands of small businesses and individuals. News coverage and public education have been haphazard. Many in the region know about specific pollution sources such as forest fires, heavy metals, or coal train cars. The concentration of one or two pollutants leads to broad generalizations about the quality of our air. For Portlanders to understand the 15 different air toxics that are negatively affecting our health, coordinated information systems are required. The recommendations that we made are outlined in your executive summary. Some of them involve some regulation changes. Some of them involve behavior changes within DEQ. Our number one recommendation is that we would like to see DEQ acquire more metro area monitoring stations for proper analysis of what is in the air that we breathe. We would like to see them more fully enforce existing wood stove regulation we would like to see more cooperation between the various affected governmental agencies. We would like to see the DEQ become more transparent in the way that we understand its budgeting process and how those monies are spent on a regional and local basis. We would like to see DEQ be able to more freely apply for federal and other grant monies in order to expand their programming. We would also like to see greater cooperation between local and local governmental agencies to explore public financing or loan options for wood stove replacement and diesel engine retrofits. We'd like to see the EQC adopt California emission standards for heavy-duty diesel trucks. We'd like to see all agencies within the airshed adopt California's construction contract requirements. We'd like to see the legislature authorize DEQ to regulate the operation of non-road diesel equipment. And we would like to ask DEQ to please determine the proper level of funding necessary in order to implement its area goals and plans for the Portland airshed. As always, in so many areas of our life today involving government and private enterprise, dollars can be the defining issue. We found that the return on investment for regulation is enormous, and we discovered this as a result of our research project. We came across a gentleman by the name of John Graham, who currently is dean of the Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs, and he was the prior administrator of the Congressional Office of Management and Budget, Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs under George W. Bush. He wrote, he was hired by George Bush to get rid of the late Clinton-era diesel emission standards. So he came on board to do that. This is what he found. The highway diesel rule was certainly costly, imposing annualized expenses of $3 to $5 billion per year on refineries and engine suppliers. Despite the significant costs, what impressed me about the rule was the in-depth benefits analysis prepared by EPA. The rule was projected to prevent, each year, 8,300 premature deaths, 5,500 cases of chronic bronchitis, and 361,400 asthma attacks. When the benefits were expressed in monetary units, they were roughly 20 times larger than the estimated costs. We wanted to relate those kinds of returns on investment to what the costs, additional costs of health care are in the state of Oregon because of pollution. In February of 2008, a report was published by the Oregon Environmental Commission, that showed that the estimate of the total cost of environmentally attributable diseases and disability in the state of Oregon is $1.5 billion annually. That includes the costs of treating adult and childhood asthma at $30 million, childhood asthma in addition to that of $27 million, adult cardiovascular disease, $342 million, and adult and childhood cancers of $131 million. It's unclear to us exactly how much of that is a result of toxic air. If a tenth of it is a result of toxic air, at a minimum, we're going to save, in the state of Oregon, tens of millions of dollars a year. Because of the population concentrations of the poor along transportation corridors, we find that they are much more affected by diesel emissions and automobile emissions than other populations. These are the populations that are more likely to be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And so my tax dollars and yours and all Oregon taxpayers' dollars are paying for additional costs of health care due to these pollutants and toxics in our air.
Good morning. I'm Peter Livingston, and I was the chair of the City Club Committee. In organizing this presentation, we decided it would be more effective to have the background presented first. But I was the chair. Maria wrote the report, and Spencer is now the chair of the committee that is advocating for the conclusions in the report. And just by way of background, the way the City Club chooses members of a committee is to screen them carefully for bias and capability. And so when the committee met, it was clear that we had no axe to grind. We were people simply looking for information about this issue. And we interviewed 35 witnesses from government, from the state, from neighborhood advocacy groups. We tried to cover the whole gamut of people, and often would ask for recommendations from our witnesses for other witnesses so that we wouldn't miss anybody important. The question that we were asked to answer was ultimately, what did we want? And to reduce it to its simplest terms, what's needed here is money. And it's money to pay for better information and also for some of the programs that could come from that information, like wood stove reduction. The biggest issue is covered by our first recommendation, and that is more funds for monitoring. This is a recommendation that was supported by all of our witnesses. One of the problems that comes up is that the last data that was done was assembled in a comprehensive manner dates back to 2005, and since then the data is effectively the result of manipulation and modeling, and there are not enough monitoring stations in the Portland area, Portland airshed, to collect the data that would persuade everybody that action is required. So the first objective would be to have more monitoring stations and fund them adequately. And they, every time they assemble data, it's good for a period of time, like a year or 2 years, 3 years. But we're now 8 years after the last effort to collect data. And I think the important thing here is that not only is there going to be a great savings in medical costs if the problem of air toxicity is addressed, but also everybody who gets sick experiences a fair amount of anguish. And we are focusing on the economic aspects, but you should not forget that children with asthma, people with cancer, suffer a good deal. And if an effort were made to fund the activities of DEQ more adequately, a lot of this suffering would go away. Now, I'm going to introduce Maria Everhart, who was the writer of the report and who is probably the person most qualified to answer technical questions.
My name is Maria Everhart. I'm the mother of two, and some friends thought that as I wanted to return to full-time work as my children got older, that the City Club would be a great place to volunteer for a study committee and meet a lot of people and, hear about jobs and things like that. So, as Peter mentioned, I didn't have really an opinion about air pollution when we started. except I was pretty sure you could see Mount Hood more often. That was about the extent of my awareness of it over the 30 years I've lived in Portland. I wanted to talk a little bit about the monitoring, you know, why this is the number one recommendation, because many people are going to say, oh, we have enough information, let's just, you know, fix things. And I just wanted to kind of get a little bit into the weeds. Spencer, would you show the next slide? There are 15 of these, one for each chemical, referenced in our report, that the DEQ has found is probably a problem in the Portland metro airshed. DEQ started with 52 chemicals in Oregon, and for Portland, down to about 15, about 8 or too high. And this looks like we know the answer. We know that there's too much cadmium in that little, that's Pearl District. It's west of I-45 and on up to the Forest Park Hills. It looks like we have a problem. It's very reassuring with the level of detail and stuff. But notice it says Portland Air Toxic 2017 modeling results. And this is where I wanted to talk about, it's not that we're saying the modeling is not accurate. It's probably terrific. Modeling is great at predicting where problems are likely to be, but it's essentially math. And what modeling is great at is compiling huge streams of information into something we can understand, which is a simple picture. So our understanding of DEQ's modeling is that they put together traffic data, weather data, population data, all of their permit data, where they allow different industries to put out X amount of different pollutants, some traffic planning data that's done at Metro. They smash all this together in mathematical equations they call algorithms, and you have this. But what modeling can't do since 2005, when we had five monitors for a year, is it can't say what's changed about individual behavior. So if you could show the next, Yeah, this is another modeling result for at the other end of the continuum, sort of 15 polyaromatic hydrocarbons comes from wood smoke mainly. It's like more than 10 times the benchmark all over the entire airshed. What we don't know, though, is how many people in the last 8 years have just voluntarily gotten a certified wood stove, upgraded their home equipment that is now certified, in which case the problem could be, if everybody got a certified wood stove, that two-thirds of the problem would be solved. So this is why we need more monitors. We need to know what is. And the other thing I just wanted to mention about monitors is that as soon as you propose something like helping people replace their wood stove that costs a few million dollars, so it's still great on the return on investment calculations Spencer was sharing with us, as soon as you propose it, there's going to be people who say, well, how do we know we really have a problem? And they're going to say, well, that data you've got is from 2005. And it's going to be an argument over what is the problem rather than an argument over how to solve the problem. And so I just wanted to show these two extremes of some of the maps that we poured over during our year, just to show how we'd really like to know. The modeling is probably at its best with things that are related to industry, like cadmium, because that probably hasn't changed, or if it's changed, DEQ knows and can put that into the model that they handed out as slightly different permits. But on things that are individual behavior, like car purchases and wood stove burning or fireplace insert burning, or I suppose some consumer products that are part of our air toxics, we need actual data that you can't really argue with. That's kind of what I wanted to be sure to say. Could you click? I wanted everyone to see this table's in the report, of course, and it. These are only the first six of the 15 that are of concern, although these are the six red stop signs in the far right column. And the reason, it's hard to believe, but the reason wood combustion's a problem is because it is part of five of the top six. It's the main top source. So it's hard to believe. That sounds like a 19th century problem, but it's, I've done some back of the envelope math, as Spencer did on return on investment. PSU surveyed 1,300 citizens at random about their wood stove use in 2009 at DEQ's request, and it looks like 2% of this airshed's homes still heat with wood. And when you do that kind of math, that means there's probably about 14,000 homes heating with wood. It's not a big number. And PSU's research also showed that probably 45% of them are uncertified. In other words, 55% of people, the majority, have already upgraded their equipment to be a certified wood stove. So now we're only talking about 6,000 stoves that need changing. And Eugene's Lane Air Quality Agency, LRAPA, is helping people do this. And it's about $1,800 per stove to change it out. And so, you know, it's about 6,000 times, I don't know. So it's somewhere around $10 million. So that sounds like a lot. But the reason that that very big orange map can be 10 times over, you can click back to that. This is how I want you to think of it. When I say the word air pollution, most people think of a smokestack. But what I realized is that what this is instead of smokestacks you can see from a great distance, this is 6,000 little smokestacks that have never been cleaned, scrubbed, catalytic converter, all the stuff that we do on our industry smokestacks. And when you spread 6,000 little smokestacks all over town, you end up with a problem. That's what it took me about a year to stop being skeptical that wood smoke could be our number one concern in air toxins.
Thank you. Very sobering report. And colleagues, I'll note that the full report is on OLIS, so you have access to the full report. And we thank you for your time in coming down and presenting. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks so much for putting all this work into it. And as private citizens, it's great that you're able to step up and do this kind of work to give information to us. I had some questions about the table that had the different air toxic pollutants. Were they ranked because the first six because they are the most commonly found or because they are the most detrimental health-wise? You know, I mean, we're talking about, it sounds like wood smoke pollution is where we're finding a lot, but are they creating the most health hazards, or are we looking at different sources that produce greater health hazards?
I would say it was health-wise because our DEQ, Oregon's DEQ, we wanted to be sure and get this out, so it's a good opportunity, is actually at the absolute forefront of trying to address these air toxics among state air quality agencies, because what they did is a different committee of scientists spent about 7 or 8 years developing health-based benchmarks, they call it, which are levels that we ought to shoot for. They're aspiration. They call them aspirational goals, aspirational standards, that basically they took all the, you know, this committee sounds a lot tougher than ours. They took all the science of the amounts that cause health problems and translated that into an ambient level that's not a standard yet, but it's a health-based benchmark. And then all we did is read, you know, the results, and I came up with the idea of the red stop sign, the yellow stop sign, and green stop sign to say, okay, this is, you know, more than 10 times as high as the health-based benchmark that DEQ suggests all over the city, or this one, cadmium, is just really, really high in a small area. So I did the ranking, or, you know, the committee was behind me, but the original information was health-based benchmarks.
So the graph here is more the prevalence of the pollutant in the air?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or the amount it exceeds an ideal goal.
Okay.
In multipliers. The red is 5 to 10 times higher. The green are things that are right at or below the health-based benchmarks that they came up with separately. They came up with it separately from what is. They came up with it from what, you know, what ought to be according to. I think they must have spent a year on each chemical to try to come up with those.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for doing this. It's very interesting. And I noticed on page 3 of your summary, item 3, it talks about the EPA regulations and how they regulate smog and lead differently from air toxics, and yet there's no recommendation based on that. Could you give us a little background on...
Ooh. Well, we discussed that it was probably beyond the scope of the City Club to have recommendations for EPA, and so we didn't really try to figure out how ambient standards probably should be set for 8 or 10 of these most common air toxics, because it just seemed out of our realm of influence, circle of influence.
Yes. Please.
There's one thing to clarify, and that is that when it comes to criteria pollutants, smog, the EPA has focused on them and has funded efforts to control them. When air toxics are involved, the EPA is much less willing to fund measures to reduce them, so the burden lands on the state.
And each state has different ones, whereas the smog pollutants are the same all over the country, 6 smog pollutants. If you're an agency like a city, county, or tribal organization, you can't exceed this ambient standard in those 6 pollutants. You can't. Or your federal highway dollars at risk, other federal grant money's at risk, the EPA starts breathing down your neck. I think there's even a mechanism where they can take over your air quality operations as a separate. So that is a completely different method of reducing those chemicals than for the 190 across the nation air toxics, and luckily each state usually only has to tackle a couple dozen like we have our 15. The main standard is that when industry asks for a permit, they have to show that they're achieving maximum achievable control technology, which it means that their smokestack is as good or better as the top 10% of industry practice. So that benchmark, if you will, moves every 10 or so years, but it's a very different thing than an ambient standard that you cannot exceed this many parts per million. We don't have that yet for any of the air toxics. We have these maximum achievable control technologies, which is more about how much it has to be a large industry that produces the toxic, which isn't true for wood smoke, and you know how much they're allowed is based on how much everybody else with the latest, greatest equipment is able to accomplish.
Representative Whitsitt?
Cardin.
I was wondering, on the acrolene, you note that the primary cause would be forest fires, and I'd just like to say that in Klamath Lake, Jackson, and Douglas counties, sometimes we sit for multiple weeks or months, depending on the year, under excessive amounts of smoke in the summer months. It has nothing to do with burning wood stoves, and yet I would question how are we going to control that, or you know, does that outweigh all the rest of the wood smoke during the year if we're subjected to it day after day after day after day and we can't control it? Does really controlling wood stoves, and I understand what you're saying, but how's that offset? What is a more primary concern?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Whitsitt, I think I could help address that question, which is really beyond the scope of our committee work. But I am a land use attorney, and I've had to address forest fire questions in different cases. One of the issues that exists is that while the Department of Forestry is concerned about forest fires, they also are balancing those concerns against the demands of the timber industry, and sometimes perhaps they are less vigilant than they could be because of that pressure.
If I may, we primarily see U.S. Forest Service lands in our area being burned. They're not private, and they're not Oregon. They're U.S. Forest Service, and I would argue that perhaps we need to have some laws regarding cleaning up the forests so that we don't have these massive forest fires that are destroying our air quality first.
Mm-hmm. I would say that this is you eat the elephant one bite at a time, and that's why these rankings are simply, you know, how far above health-based benchmark is the Portland metro area, but the recommendations don't necessarily, you know, track it perfectly, because you're right. Forest fires and structural fires, which used to be a much bigger Portland problem because we had the biggest city, are the main contributors to that. And so all you can hope to do with wood smoke control is, you know, maybe whack away at acrolein by, I don't know, 25% or so. But since wood smoke's in four or five of these, you start whacking away at the total, and it does improve health, even though you can't solve the, if you can't solve the forest fire problem.
Appreciate that response, Representative Whitsitt. I would comment, having sat through the Subcommittee on Natural Resources of Ways and Means presentation yesterday from the Department of Forestry, in which we discovered that there's an extra $40 million that will be coming out of general fund for that, that if we are able to reduce fires, we might also be able to, in addition to improving air quality, that $40 million would more than pay for air quality monitoring across the state, as well as we could just buy every wood stove and switch it out for that $40
million.
That's
right. That's right. Probably $1 million in Bedford. Our second air monitor came to us in December as a city, as a metro area, but it had to be taken from Medford. So three across the state under DEQ's control is not enough. You know, we shouldn't steal from Medford to put a second one out in Hillsborough. And the other thing I wanted to mention is we're pretty sure Eugene is handled differently. They have a local regional air quality board, and they handle Lane County completely differently outside of DEQ for air quality. They have about four or five monitors, so that they've spent their money differently, their same amount of money.
Thank you. Sure. Representative Benz, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2 of your report, you say, however, no federal, state, metro area ambient standards exist for air toxics. Why is that? Your research must have indicated the reason we haven't developed those standards yet.
That's what I was trying to take a crack at with the maximum achievable control technology. Nowhere in the country really has set ambient standards for any but a handful of these 52 air toxics. They came along later. The list was released by the federal government in 1990, so that's 20 years after the Clean Air Act. And in that 20 years, additional standards had only been able to be wrangled through Congress for about 7 things. So the regulators and the industrial emitters kind of said, look, this could take the rest of everybody's life and their grandchildren's life to work at these chemicals one by one. Let's agree that we're all going to try to do better, and so we're all going to shoot for this top 10% of, you know, the best available technology in any given industry. But that means it's regulated industry by industry and permit by permit, and it's not regulated the same way at all as the Clean Air Act regulates. You can't have more than 35 parts per million, you know, the carbon monoxide or whatever the standard is. I don't have it in front of me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going through this, looking at it, the other thing I'd be kind of curious on, too, and I don't know if you did it in your study, is looking at air pollution at different times of the year and how that varies as well. So, I mean, we're looking at wood stoves. They usually burn in the wintertime when you have rain and it filters it out, and air quality usually is better in the wintertime than it is in the summertime, where we have the forest fires, and then they'll drift over the hills and set in place. Is it really the wood stoves, or is it something else? I mean, if wood stoves are an issue, it's easy to do a tax credit or a trade-in or something like that on them. But I think the problem's probably bigger than the wood stove that we're looking at. And the other thing would be looking at economical power that people can afford because they're burning wood stoves, not because they love to go out and cut wood, because I grew up with a fireplace in my house, and it's because power prices are high and they can't afford power. So you're looking at hitting vulnerable people when you start attacking their wood stoves. So we need to look out for the consumers and the people in these areas, because the people who haven't upgraded their wood stoves are probably people who can't afford to.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to see how the air quality is over a time period of a year or a couple of years, where it is in the winter, summer, and probably 1 year would give you a real good idea on that as well. So, and I didn't see anything here. I don't know if you've done it or not, but if you could get that to me, I would appreciate it.
You can probably trust this to be from the year of 2005 data. You know, you can kind of
but I meant
trust it
summer versus that. Winter.
Representative, we may be able to follow up with DEQ also on getting that information.
Yeah, to see how they use their monitoring data.
I'm getting head nods from Director Peterson in the back, so he can probably follow up on that.
If I may, that might be one of the advantages of adding to our monitoring capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think it's important to point out, although you're calling for additional DEQ action, investment, monitoring, and so forth, that DEQ in Oregon does have rules that go up and beyond what EPA regulations are. So I think it's important to put that, to get that out there, and I'm sure that our department head could testify to that. But they are active, and active beyond what the feds require, certainly. So there obviously there are always things that we can improve on. But I guess just two comments. One of my concerns is that what you identify, I think a lot of people could characterize as a Portland-centric problem. The problem some of us in rural Oregon are concerned about is sometimes Portland-centric problems lead to statewide of solutions that can impact folks who, i.e. in the wood stove area, you know, heating with wood is a very desired, efficient way for much of rural Oregon to heat themselves in the winter. So
mm-hmm.
I just want to get that out there. You know, sometimes it'd be great if we could preface these reports and say it would only apply to cities or municipalities with plus 500,000 populations, and allow those regulations to apply in a metro area like that rather than impact the folks in Baker and LeGrand and out in the Hood River Valley where people enjoy that. You cited some cost-benefit analysis or return on investments for making additional or changes in air quality, i.e. in medical costs. I'm wondering what kind of data you can cite, i.e. specific connections between, I think you're referring to cancer-causing conditions and so forth. What medical sources are you citing for that? Do you have any direct links to that we can use as evidence for that? Or are we just extrapolating or modeling based on something?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. To reiterate again, the analysis was done by EPA and was cited by the Office of Management and Budget in papers that were written in 2002.
We're not talking about American Medical Association or some sort of journal from a medical field. We're talking about someone in another agency who's making these determinations.
I don't know the sources for EPA's analysis.
Thank you.
My understanding is that they are held by Congress to certain standards, so that when they cost their regulation, they've got to be pretty accurate.
We thank you very much for your time and coming down, and for all the work that you put into this report. It's extremely helpful. I hope that this is I will note to the committee that this is the start of a continuing conversation. I think there is broad agreement on the need for, at a minimum, better monitoring to better understand the problem, to get better data and a better baseline. I think we can hopefully build a coalition around that, move forward, and I appreciate you kicking off this conversation in this committee. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Chair Bailey.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Close the informational hearing on the air toxics report and open an informational hearing on Bonneville Power Administration and the Northwest Power and Conservation Council overview. Colleagues, this is a chance for us to learn a bit more about two major entities here that determine our power future and planning. And I'd like to invite up Crystal Ball, Bill Bradbury, and Henry Lorenzen, please. Yes.
Really?
Okay.
All right. And whoever would like to begin can begin here.
Do you mind if I go first?
You want a chair?
I want a chair.
Get your chair.
I'd like to note that our former Secretary of State is joining us, and it's an honor to have you in front of this committee, sir. Appreciate you being here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair. Would you like us to start?
In whatever order you would like to proceed.
Henry and I would like to do a joint presentation with your permission.
Please.
Chair Bailey and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee, really thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Bill Bradbury, and with me is Henry Lorenzen. And we are the two Oregon representatives to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. I am currently the chair of the council and serve on the Fish and Wildlife Committee. And Henry chairs the Public Affairs Committee and serves on the Power Committee. The council is really a unique organization. It's a four-state compact established through the passage of the 1980 Northwest Power Act passed by the Congress. The states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana participate in the council, and two representatives from each state are appointed by their respective governors. I think all of us know that the Columbia River is a big river. It is, in fact, 1,215 miles long, and it begins not in this country, but in Columbia Lake in British Columbia, Canada. And it starts at an elevation of 2,656 feet above sea level. Its annual water volume is about 190 million acre feet at the mouth, and it is the fourth largest river in North America by volume. Obviously, it is a working river, and throughout the history of its development, it has been used for hydropower production, navigation, irrigation, fishing, and recreation.
I'll start in. My name, as Bill's mentioned, is Henry Lorenzen. I'm from Pendleton, Oregon area, and I'm very fortunate to be able to serve on the Power Planning Council. My prior background has been one where I have principally represented electric cooperatives. I did that for almost 30 years prior to joining the council, and I, as a result of joining the council, I no longer represent those cooperatives. So just to make that clear, the current hydroelectric system on the Columbia River began in about 1938 with the construction of the Bonneville Dam and then the establishment of the Bonneville Power Administration. One of its principal goals was to provide electricity to the rural areas and to do it become an economic engine for the development of the Northwest. It has been very successful in doing this. Up until the mid-1960s, the ever-increasing demand for electricity was met generally through the construction of additional hydroelectric facilities, but then it became apparent, at least at that time, that because of the increasing demand, additional generation would have to be developed other than the hydroelectric system. And in 1968, a program which was labeled the Hydrothermal Power Program began planning for the future of electricity in the Northwest. And that was the genesis of what ultimately became WOOPS power plants, 1 through 5. And finally, and the ultimate result was only one was actually completed where it generates electricity. And it also resulted in a very rapid escalation of electric power rates in the Northwest. And I started my representation of electric cooperatives just shortly after the blow-up of the whoops situation. I can tell you it caused a great deal of consternation, not only among the members of those cooperatives, but also among their directors. The directors were voted out. There was great concern about how the region would go forward in dealing with planning for the power. Also, what became evident as a result of the escalation of power rates is that electricity, demand for electricity, did in fact follow the classic economic elastic demand model, that when prices go up, demand goes down. And it also at that time began to become apparent that one of the more wise ways of meeting future electric requirements was to have a reduction in electric usage, and that's where conservation came in. And also this was the beginning of and the foundation for the establishment of the Power Planning Council through the adoption of the Regional Power Act. And there was a tension at that time. There was a desire for the region through its governors and its states to have an additional impact and influence over the very significant decisions of Bonneville Power Administration, how it went about meeting its responsibility for developing additional resources. The tension also was that there was a real concern among, particularly among the preference customers, that Bonneville not be subjected to strong regulation by another body. So when you read the Act itself, there's a real kind of a balancing that goes on between what the Council is able to do and what direct authority it has and what Bonneville is required to do in terms of following the Council's conclusions and its direction through its power plan. And this is one, as a lawyer, I find very interesting to try to struggle through that act to see exactly what the defining roles are. My background has been one of, you know, serving on the Environmental Quality Commission in Oregon, Fish and Wildlife, Higher Ed, where they looked the statutory scheme in many respects, and you can get, at least in theory, a very clear definition of what those authorities are. But when you read the Act, there's an ambiguity there that also has been applied and has been, I guess, clarified over the years in terms of how it's been actually applied.
So on one hand, you had consumers very concerned about electricity rates, and that led to the initial drafting of the legislation to create the council. And during the same time period, fish and wildlife managers and tribes in the region watched with growing alarm as the region's fish population dropped and dropped and dropped. The causes for that decline are multiple, and we're still trying to understand all of those causes and try to mitigate for them. Obviously, they include development of dams. They include fishing and sometimes overfishing, habitat loss, effects of artificial production, hatchery impacts on native stocks, and poor water quality, which you were just spending some time talking about. So at the same time that there was a clamor for us to fix the electrical system, there was a real clamor to fix the salmon problem as well. So in 1980, the Northwest Power Act was, in fact, adopted by Congress. It authorized the states to form the council and directed this new organization to develop a 20-year forecast of electricity need and develop a plan for resources focused on least cost ones first. The Act places special emphasis on energy efficiency and directs the Bonneville Power Administration to acquire resources consistent with the Council's power plan. The power plan includes the Fish and Wildlife Program, which the council updates every 5 years, and which the council is updating as we speak right now, to protect, mitigate, and enhance fish and wildlife that have been affected by the Columbia River Basin hydropower system. Finally, the council is mandated to involve the public in its decision-making, which is why we hold meetings and hearings around the region to try to take in as much public comment as possible. Now, speaking specifically to the Fish and Wildlife Program, the Power Act directs the council to develop the Fish and Wildlife Program first, and then to develop the power plan. The council's first Fish and Wildlife Program was adopted in 1982. The emphasis in that program was on dam passage of juvenile and adult anadromous fish that emerges, emerge from and then return to spawn in the river system. And today, the program's emphasis is on habitat measures with a secondary push for artificial production to mitigate for habitat loss by blocking fish passage. Now, the program directs actions by the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But Bonneville must act consistent with the program and with the power plan. Bonneville implements the program and, I think most importantly, has used its funds to make substantial improvements for fish and wildlife throughout the Columbia Basin. It is the largest fish and wildlife restoration effort in the world that's going on today in the Columbia Basin. For one example, to address wildlife losses identified in the Fish and Wildlife Program, in 2010, then Bonneville Administrator Steve Wright and then Governor Ted Kulongoski signed the Willamette Memorandum of Agreement, committing more than $144 million in Bonneville funding for wildlife habitat protection in the Willamette Valley. And I'll let Bonneville explain more what they've accomplished, but it's been a very substantial and significant effort. The council is currently in the process of updating its Fish and Wildlife Program. We asked for recommendations from all over the region, and we have received nearly 700 suggestions for measures to include in the new plan. Right now, we're in the process of sifting through all these suggestions, and we'll come out with a draft plan in February of 2014. I should note that the recommendations come from all across the region, from state, federal, and tribal fish and wildlife managers, from utilities, environmental groups, and interested individuals. The recommendations cover topics addressed in previous programs like artificial production, selective harvest, hydrosystem passage, and specific habitat measures. However, we received recommendations for new areas of the program, such as toxic contamination in the Columbia and its effects on fish and wildlife, the potential for invasive species such as zebra and quagga mussels to really gum things up, and enhancements for programs for other fisheries in the Columbia like sturgeon, lamprey, and smelt, among other species. A majority of the recommendations included a component on an issue close to my heart, climate change, and it acknowledged that the challenges before the region are great and require us to accommodate a different snowpack and a different level of precipitation that we're likely to see. That will no doubt alter the amount and quality of water available for fishing and passage, as well as for hydropower production. The council has included the concepts of climate change in its previous fish and wildlife program and in the sixth power plan, and the new program and the seventh power plan will no doubt place emphasis on the challenges posed by a changing climate as well.
it's easy to say, it's clear to say that we cannot predict the future with great deal of certainty. And sitting here listening to the City Club presentation reminded me that it was in, I think, the late 70s, early 80s, I was lucky enough to attend a City Club speech by then BPA Administrator Don Hodel, who mentioned that the lights were going to be going out if we did not aggressively embark upon a program to bring about or to construct a significant number of additional thermal generation plants, which, again, as I mentioned earlier, led to the whoops problem. The council, through its very capable staff, and this is something I, in my year and a half of serving on the council, have come to appreciate, is just the high quality of individuals that we're fortunate to have working on the staff. But they, instead of, they've developed what really has been a model that has been followed in the industry. That is, instead of trying to predict one future that might hold in terms of additional power needs, they've gone to more of a range, and developing that range through very sophisticated modeling involving, with technical terms, stochastic modeling, just probabilistic modeling, taking into consideration numerous different types of events such as historic stream flows, historic temperature, and so on. And then in looking at those ranges, then to develop a power plan that would most efficiently satisfy what would be the projected needs of the power system, taking into account risk and probabilities. As Bill has mentioned, in developing the power plan, we first look at the Fish and Wildlife Program, because the power plan has to be built upon that Fish and Wildlife Program in order to accommodate it in its first instance. And in the past, and we project that this will also be true in the next power plan, which we're in the process of developing, is that the resource with the lowest cost and lowest risk will be energy efficiency and conservation. The estimates on that is that, that to implement conservation, it costs somewhere between one-third and a half less than developing new power plants. But, you know, I'll break for a moment just from my prepared material. This also presents a real challenge to the retail utilities, because as conservation, and it has to do with the way electric rates are structured, each month, our consumer receives each month a bill that breaks out between fixed charges and charges for the amount of energy used. Those fixed charges do not come close to covering the fixed overhead to the utilities, so they're heavily dependent upon the volumetric sales of energy, in order to cover those fixed charges. And as those sales go down as a result of conservation, that contribution to fixed overheads also goes down. But also it becomes very politically very difficult to change the billing methodology, where that fixed monthly charge, I've often heard that for a residential customer, instead of the typical $15 to $18 a month, should be closer to $50 or $55 a month. It becomes politically very difficult to do that. So, as a result, especially among rural utilities where they are experiencing no load growth, or in many cases, like in the area that I had represented in the northeastern Oregon area, where there's a significant reduction in load because of the fall off in the timber products industries, the utilities are facing increasing pressures to raise rates, which also then brings in with cooperatives, which is a model of a democratic organizations. It brings increasing pressure upon the directors, because the newspaper and headlines will say electric rates are projected to go up by 8%. And they really don't look at, and it's more difficult to come out and analyze carefully what the ultimate power bill is as a result of conservation, which may actually result in less cost to the consumer, but it's difficult, and it's a public relations issue when rates go up, even though ultimate costs go down. The power plan directs, or not the plan, but the act directs that we should be giving order of priority to looking at future needs of power, first to energy conservation and energy efficiency, secondly to development of renewables, which actually has been occurring through Oregon's renewable portfolio standard, as well as those in place in other states in the Northwest. Idaho is the only one without it, but Idaho is also experiencing significant development of renewables through other statutory schemes, such as the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act. What's going to be different in the next power plan is, and it's a very serious issue in the Northwest, and one that and around, in particularly California, and the Northwest also is tied to California through the intertie, and that is the integration of the intermittent generation, the renewable resources. Within the Bonneville Balancing Authority, there's approximately 4,200 megawatts of wind. And wind is a wonderful thing for displacing fuel, in my mind, because when it blows, wind blows, you do not have to have other generation going. But in this last year, there was one day when the wind was generating 4,200 megawatts, and the next day, and I believe it was a day later, it was down to 100 megawatts. And when you have that kind of variability, there's going to be a demand upon the system to be able to respond quickly to make up for that shortfall. It may very well be in analysis of our next plan, we will identify needs for additional gas-fired generation simply to be able to stand by to meet that variability of intermittent resources. California has a particular problem. They have been very successful in implementing the renewable generation standards, and they've done it mainly through solar. When I say mainly, one of the big contributors has been solar generation. The characteristic of solar, obviously, is that it comes online very quickly in the morning when the sun comes up, and then in the evening when the sun goes down, it shuts off very quickly. But also it's exacerbated by the fact that in the evening people come home from work and start cooking and turning on their lights and raising the heat in their houses. So you have a fall off of generation, increase of load, which creates an even greater need for resources that are very flexible that can come online quickly. In the Northwest, we're very lucky. We have the hydro system that has the ability to respond quickly, but we're very close to tapping out the ability of the hydro system to provide that flexibility. And then when you take a look at the first power plant, or from between 1978 to 2011, just simply to put conservation in perspective, we have probably saved more than 5,000 average megawatts, and which is 10 large 500-megawatt power plants. And these savings have come from a variety of areas, utility programs such as the implementation of compact fluorescent lights, energy efficiency that's come by mandates from federal government, things such as refrigerators and television standards, state building codes, and then entities such as the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance has been very successful in getting things such as compact fluorescent bulbs into stores such as Home Depot and Fred Meyer prior to the 2001 West Coast energy crisis. The other thing I might say, my background is I'm an electrical engineer as well, and one of the things that has I would say impressed me and also surprised me. When I first came onto the council, I carefully read the Regional Power Act. I read the sixth power plan, and I thought that my work would be, and the council's work would be, as it historically had set out to be, and that is to look into the future and determine what additional power plants are going to be needed. But what has evolved, and the question also is often what is the relevancy today of the council and its staff, when probably the system has changed dramatically from what was anticipated when the act was passed. And what was anticipated, as I mentioned, was the further development of the hydro thermal power program that Bonneville would be the entity that would coordinate or actually contract for and be responsible for developing generation. That then would be supplied to all utilities in the Northwest. So then you have the central plan that made a lot of sense. But what has evolved is that and this is my perspective, is that the council and its staff have become incredibly adept and proficient and in developing and conservation and also analyzing, not only developing the plans in a vacuum, but in analyzing very carefully what conservation would be or is capable of being achieved by various sectors of commercial, residential, industrial, irrigation, so on, so that their conservation programs can, in fact, be geared to what is in fact achievable. And they have been recognized, the staff has been recognized nationally for its work in this area. And so that's, I'm now becoming a believer more than I've ever been in the benefit of the council and in the benefit of conservation and why it's important. It's very difficult to quantify exactly what conservation not only is available, what is achievable, and what has been achieved. But the staff at the council has done, in my mind, a very, very good job in achieving that. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present this to you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate the introduction and the testimony. Ms. Ball?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Ball. I'm the Oregon liaison at the Bonneville Power Administration. Thank you for your interest in BPA and for the opportunity to talk to you today. Members of the council, thank you for an informative presentation about the council. With this presentation, I hope you'll get a better understanding about what we do at BPA, how we coordinate with the council, and how we navigate the major changes in the electric utility industry. BPA is a federal power marketing administration. We are a separate and distinct entity of the U.S. Department of Energy. We are self-funded and have limited borrowing authority from the U.S. Treasury. We do not receive a federal appropriations. We cover all of our costs, and we repay the U.S. Treasury with interest for any money that we borrow. Congress created BPA in 1937 to sell power from the Bonneville Dam to publicly owned utilities and build the electric transmission system to deliver that power. We were founded on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's idea that electricity could be an agent of social change. You see, many people in rural areas back then did not have electricity. President Roosevelt wanted to use the public waterways for public good, but he recognized that the Columbia River is an indigenous resource that should be dedicated to serving the Northwest. BPA is really big. Today, our service territory covers 4 states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. We do not own generating resources, but we are responsible for marketing the power from the 31 federal projects in the Columbia River Basin that are owned and operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. We also market power from 1 non-federal nuclear plant that is not owned by BPA, but by Energy Northwest. The governor's 10-year energy plan acknowledges the federal system creates substantial value for Oregon through low-cost, reliable, emission-free power that creates an economic advantage not found outside the Northwest. The federal resource is a major component of Oregon's electricity mix, and the BPA transmission system is the backbone of the electricity structure. Over 15,000 circuit miles of BPA high-voltage transmission lines crisscross the Northwest, moving power from where it's generated to where it's consumed. BPA is a wholesale electric utility, not a retail utility. Consumer-owned utilities buy power from BPA under 20-year contracts. In Oregon, these preference customers include electric cooperatives, municipalities, and people's utility districts. The long-term power contracts fully allocate the base federal system under a tiered rate structure. Our Tier 1 power rate is about 3 cents per kilowatt hour. If customers need more power than their allocation of the system, they can choose to have BPA provide that power at a Tier 2 rate. Some large industries, tribal governments, and other federal agencies buy power directly from BPA, too. Investor-owned utilities don't buy power directly from BPA under long-term contracts, but residential customers of PGE and Pacific Power receive a share of the benefit of the Columbia River system through a program called the Residential Exchange that lowers electric rates. PacifiCorp and PGE are also two of BPA's largest transmission customers. For example, the utility used BPA's transmission system to provide wind power to their users. Power marketers and other resource developers also use our transmission system. And we sell or exchange power with utilities in Canada, California, and other parts of the Western United States. And as you heard from Chair Bradbury and Councilmember Lorenzen, there's a council, and that council guides BPA. Two areas where BPA closely coordinates with the council are regional power planning and Fish and Wildlife Program. The council plan assures the region and adequate, efficient, economical and reliable power supply. As Councilmember Lorenzen pointed out, the plan guides electric power resource acquisition, preferring conservation as a resource, and sets regional conservation targets. BPA's current energy efficiency program is consistent with the Council's 6 power plan, which ensures the region invests in energy efficiency rather than new generation facilities for 85% of the expected load growth. BPA works directly with utility customers to develop the programs and incentives that encourage more energy efficient use in their homes and businesses. And as Chair Bradbury explained, the act that created the council also called for BPA to protect, mitigate, and enhance fish and wildlife affected by the dams. The council guides BPA's fish and wildlife investments. Protection of the Northwest's iconic steelhead and salmon populations, including those listed as threatened or endangered under federal law, is the most visible feature of BPA's Fish and Wildlife Program. BPA ratepayers fund the largest fish and wildlife mitigation program. In 2012, BPA directly invested more than $450 million to address the impacts of the federal dams in just 1 year. Beyond BPA's direct funding, operations at the dams that protect fish but reduce hydropower generation also affect our revenues and rates. Our mission is to provide reliable and adequate power and transmission service at low rates and to mitigate impacts of the federal system on fish and wildlife. The four pillars of our vision to achieve this mission are system reliability, low rates, environmental stewardship, and accountability to the region. We pursue this mission in the context of a rapidly evolving industry. Regional power loads dropped about 9% during the Depression, and growth is expected to be flat or slightly increase. And climate change is creating uncertainty. Continued warming will likely alter the flow of the Columbia River. And neighboring California has launched a cap-and-trade platform to combat global warming by putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions. California's initiative will likely affect electricity prices in the Northwest and the types of new generation that are developed. Furthermore, the volume and pace of new electric reliability standards continues to increase, which creates new capital and expense requirements for BPA. And the shifting energy mix is creating supply uncertainties. The renewable portfolio standards in the West and the federal production tax credit have driven significant growth in new renewable resources like wind. While this has been an opportunity to add new resources to the Pacific Northwest mix, it's also created some challenges from large swings of unexpected output and increased BPA's obligation to provide balancing reserves. This chart demonstrates how quickly the wind came on the system. There are over 4,000 megawatts of installed wind capacity in just the BPA Balancing Authority. That wasn't the case just 5 years ago. Wind is here in part because of the robust transmission line system and because of the hydropower system. Given all these changes in our industry, you might wonder how we decide what to focus on. We have identified key priorities. These priorities support our strategic objectives and are especially critical to fulfilling our mission. Our first focus is generation and transmission system assets and value. Our system is aging. Remember, I said we were created in 1937. At the same time, we face high operational demands from a new era of variable generation and the potential for new market structures. Our goal is to preserve and enhance the system through robust asset management and capital investments. And we are building new transmission lines to meet new demands. And we are also exploring new approaches to operating the system and capturing its value, like demand response and the smart grid, which Lee Hall will tell you about as soon as we're done. The Columbia River Treaty has been a major focus for us this year. The treaty is an international agreement that provides significant flood control and power generation benefits to the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada. The treaty does not expire. While the treaty has no specified end date, it does contain provisions that will change in 2024. Additionally, either Canada or the U.S. can modify or terminate the treaty in 2024 with 10 years advance notice. That's why we've been focused on 2014. The treaty's review is being coordinated through the sovereign review process. And Oregon's representatives, especially Bill Bradbury, have actively participated in that process. Our goal is to recommend a course of action to the U.S. State Department with substantial regional support. And we are on track to deliver that recommendation by the end of this year. BPA is committed to capturing the 85% target identified in the Council's 6 Power Plan. We believe that energy saved through efficiency is the most cost-effective solution for meeting our customers' load growth. Energy efficiency investments also enable our customers to extend the value of their allocation of low-cost BPA Tier 1 power by deferring the need to purchase two-tier power or other resource acquisitions. And integrating the output of the region's new energy resources requires expanding balancing capabilities and resources. To do that, we are working on developing and enhancing operational tools and technologies to better manage the deployment of balancing reserves, developing solutions for managing high wind and high water events, and exploring the potential participation in a regional energy imbalance market. The amount of electricity being generated must precisely match at all times the amount of electricity being used. The federal hydro system has been the principal source of balancing reserves for managing fluctuations, but that system is limited. It is vital that we broaden access to non-federal balancing reserves, enhance operational tools, and increase regional coordination. And our final key focus is implementing our Fish and Wildlife Program, which is essential to our environmental stewardship in the Columbia Basin and includes effective and efficient mitigation for the impacts of the federal dams. Increasing juvenile fish survival at the dams is an important part of the overall strategy. Effective spill and structural improvements are increasing fish survival. The surface passage systems that are installed at 8 large dams on the Columbia and Snake Rivers reduce the percentage of fish that go through the turbines and decrease fish travel time through the system. BPA ratepayers have made major investments in this infrastructure, and all projects are on track to meet performance standards of 96% survival for spring migrating fish and 93% survival for summer migrants, and we fully expect that this will continue. In summary, I hope I leave you with a better idea about the size and scope of BPA. The federal system has created substantial value for Oregon. We rely on the guidance from the Council, especially for regional power planning and the Fish and Wildlife Program. And we are focused on key priorities to help us navigate major changes in our industry. Thank you for the invitation to talk about BPA. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. And colleagues, I would imagine that there are any number of topics that we could cover after these presentations. Representative Bench has been doing in yeoman's work in keeping the Columbia River Treaty in particular front and center in front of this committee and the importance of it. But it was the intention of having this overview to provide some context for future discussions that we will be having and for the anticipation of the release of the next power plan that will happen during our short session here in the legislature that will, I think, provide guidance as we look forward at our energy future. So we appreciate the overview. Are there questions from this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your hard work and your presentation. There was a great article in The Economist magazine, which I'm sure you guys saw, that talked about the challenge Europe is facing with this overcapacity of wind and solar. And the easy way to explain it is you've got an awful lot of it at a certain time of the day, and you take that load away from those who have relied upon that load 30 years into the future to pay for the plants that provide it. So the net result, of course, is that the plants' fixed investment are going broke, and all of the folks that have invested in utilities are now finding that those investments, I guess I think the article was, how did we lose $500 billion? Because that's what happened with this subsidized wind capacity, for example, or soon to be solar. To me, and you mentioned this, Henry, and I'm sure that you're talking about this, but the net result is, at least according to the article, higher prices, because what happens is your fixed capacity goes away because it can't pay for itself. So my question is, how is the BPA, and this may be a little different for us here in the Northwest because of the river and the way you guys are set up, as opposed to those who are relying upon coal and gas as the steady power as opposed to intermittent. So my question is, how are you explaining to the public at large the cost, these hidden costs of this green generation? We all want it. We all want cleaner stuff, but the cost is. You got, all of us in the business know that you've got to have a backup when the wind was blowing. We got the river. Other people have fixed systems like gas. But at the end of the day, higher cost. How are you telling people about that? What do you anticipate? And I know I don't want to hear conservation. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear the higher cost and the discussion of how you're explaining it.
Are you driving the conclusion by the question? Is what I
want. Well, at least the focus of the explanation.
Okay.
Steering you to the correct answer.
Yeah. As a good lawyer should. But a couple things. No question, Europe has found itself in a bind. I did read that article, by the way. In the Northwest, however, there's no question that the renewables are more expensive than what the historic generation has been. The ultimate question is, what do you do when you need ultimately new generation? Also, the price impacts. You can look, you know, we still enjoy in the Northwest relatively low wholesale power prices. And the other thing that, when we look at this, what's happened here, and my understanding is that the cost, unsubsidized cost of wind, is in fact coming down. It's in the neighborhood, I think, and I'm off the top of my head right now, I think it's in the neighborhood of about 8 cents a kilowatt hour. The unsubsidized cost in this region. We are, and you are absolutely correct, we are blessed with the ability of the hydro system to back it up. We also at the present time are blessed with very low natural gas prices, and that also can provide a backup that Europe does not have in terms of its ability to provide lower cost balancing reserves. But you are correct. These are social policy trade-offs that are being made. And in my mind, one of the justifications for it would be that even though at the present time it may be more costly, and I just think back about what was said. I know the analogy is not a perfect one, but when the Grand Coulee Dam was built, there was a great deal of criticism. They said, we'll never, ever need all the power that could possibly be produced by this monstrosity. When you look at renewables, such as wind, and at the present time they may be more expensive, but there, one argument could be made that by encouraging the development now, we lay out the future path. And be able to make that a, instead of reaching a crisis point where other fuels are not available, we're transitioning into that future and encouraging through a greater development of it than would otherwise be justified by the moment on the economic demand. We put ourselves in a position where we make that transition into the future in a smarter, more seamless way. That would be another justification for it. But I also recognize you're absolutely correct that it is, in fact, driving up costs. But on the other hand, I know in having dealt with some of the large data centers that are locating in the Northwest, one of the things they want in the worst way is to be able to say that their power is coming from renewable sources as a marketing strategy, because consumers generally are demanding in some respects that people and industry indicate that they are in fact relying upon these types of resources, and in fact the entities such as the data centers point to our traditional hydroelectric system also as renewable. I don't know if I answered your question, but it's I've wandered around.
Please, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well,
speak to that point.
I'm most interested in how the council and BPA are explaining to the public and the ratepayers the cost of green. Many of the costs are hidden. A good example might be the balancing that we talk about that the Columbia River provides, the necessary balancing for the intermittent nature of wind. But that locks that water into that river in a funny sort of a way. It removes from the state of Oregon the opportunity to pull some of that water out and use it for irrigation or any substantial quantity. We need it for balancing. We don't talk much about the allocation of the water in the Columbia because we need it for balancing. We don't talk about that at all. There are all of these costs that it seems to me need to be on the table and understood, one of which is the impact upon existing generation and the very real impact on those poor folks that bought stock in utilities thinking they were going to have a very, very reliable stream of dividend payments. Too bad for them. Where'd their $500 billion go? Those are the kind of things I'm wondering if you guys are calling out clearly in your plan and in your reports to your ratepayers. That was my question.
I can see we could have a very interesting lunch discussion. You're right. But at the same time, when you look back at the act under which we labor, cost does not rise to the surface very much. It does in some obtuse ways. And so, as lawyers, we tend to labor under that legislation that creates the entities for which we work. But it doesn't mean we can remain silent. And it is absolutely true that one of the tasks would be, and it is an appropriate task, to talk about what the implications are for these various social policies and what the costs ultimately are in reining into the public so that wise choices can be made that balance all impacts. Cannot argue with that.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a follow-up on Representative Vince a little bit, because I think cost is important. I mean, you say companies are locating here because they want to say they're green power, but I think it's more of a marketing aspect for them to say it. But they're also here because of cost, because our green power is cheap compared to every place else in the country. That's one of the few advantages that we have here in the Northwest. So I would think cost is a very big driver. I know
city of McMinnville, which is the area that I represent. They have a steel mill there because they are their own utility and they sell power very inexpensively to that mill. Otherwise, we would not have probably that steel plant in the town of McMinnville because who would want to be going through Dundee with their trucks? Mm-hmm. So I think when you're doing this and you start bringing stuff forward to us, these are things that mean a lot to us and to the people that we represent, because the consumers on the other end, that person that's making $40,000 a year trying to raise their children and they see their electric bill going up, they don't care if it's green power or what. They're just trying to feed their family. Mm-hmm. So these are things we have to look at, and that's what we kind of dealt with the panel before you guys with wood stoves. People don't like going out to have to cut wood. You know, I didn't enjoy getting in the back of the truck having my dad and brother throw chunks of firewood at me while I had to stack them and everything inside and get home from school, start the fire every day and things like that. It would have been nice to be able to go over there and turn that thermostat up once in a while. And this is reality for a lot of people in rural Oregon and in downtown Portland. It's their only option to have warmth and heat in the wintertime. So these are things that this committee needs to start looking at very seriously, because rates are very high for a lot of consumers in the state of Oregon. It's an unhidden cost that we're having to deal with through our whole society.
If I may mention one thing, I'm sorry if I'm prolonging this, but the under the Act, we as a council are to be looking at the most efficient economic method of providing generation, meeting the demand. The Act does, in fact, direct that we are to give a 10% benefit, or essentially to handicap other sources, but also to benefit renewables and conservation by 10%. That is the limit of what we are to do. Many of the costs that you are identifying are not directed because of the council, but because of actions by the states in mandating renewable resources. That is beyond our purview. We respond to what is being built as a result of that. So that's something also to take into consideration.
And we have a couple more questions from the dais. I would note that we have about 3 minutes before we need to transition to our next panel to make sure they have sufficient time for their presentation. Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for your good report today. Mr. Lawrenson, in your testimony, you made a statement that kind of leapt off the page where you said, we cannot predict the future. But the reality is that the policies you're advocating for are assuming some sort of determinate future regarding climate and change and so forth. But you and I can talk about that offline in a different setting. I'd like to apply it to fish, as my district in the gorge is right in the midst of the watershed and so forth that you reference. And every year it seems we get projections from Department of Fish and Wildlife about fish runs, how many salmon to expect and so forth and so on. And maybe you've been following, but this year we're actually having the record return of Chinook salmon ever. I mean, it's unbelievable. I think we're over a million fish now that have crossed at Bonneville and so forth. My question would be, does the council ever, I mean, and that's a good thing. We're thankful. I mean, we're just thankful that we've got fish filling the rivers, and we've got new runs coming up the Hood River of returning Chinook and stuff. Things are working. Does the council ever factor into its thought process that there could ever be a finish line regarding, could we ever get to the point where we said these mitigation factors that we put into place, the investments that we made, have paid off, and now we've done our work, we can either redeploy that money elsewhere for another beneficial purpose or perhaps lower rates to the suppliers that could end up lowering rates to ratepayers? Is that ever within the psyche of you, your council, and your work? Is there a finish line on some of these mitigation factors?
I can say that I'm fortunately, I serve on the Power Committee and not on the Fish and Wildlife Committee. And that is, and I've dealt with these issues on the Environmental Quality Commission when there was a request for a waiver of the water quality standards so additional spill could occur. I also saw these issues when I served on Fish and Wildlife. And they are enormously complex. And I understand your question, that I could defer to my good partner who deals with the fish and wildlife aspects of the plan.
The interesting question is, there are a couple goals the council has established for fish and wildlife recovery. One of them called a SAR, smolt to adult return. And the goal if you're going to have self-sustaining runs, is somewhere between 2% and 6% of smolt to adult return. There are some years, like this year, where there are really great returns. We're having real trouble in the Columbia River even achieving about a 1% SAR right now. So there are some years, as we all know, some years go different ways, and that's great, and we're all celebrating. But the longer-term goal is a SAR, a smolt to adult return of 2 to 6%. And I think the other goal that the council has set is to have, I'm going to say, a million fish returning annually. Is that, I know there's a specific numerical number that we've established as a goal, and this year we are hitting it.
Thank you.
Representative Whitsitt.
I just have the point. We took testimony yesterday in Ag and Natural Resources that the largest runs of six anadromous fish species are occurring in Oregon, basically within recorded history right now. And Ed Bowles, when I asked him, do you think this is related to terrestrial influence from mitigation or oceanic conditions, and he said fish and wildlife really can't tell. He said it would be too fast for the terrestrial mitigation to have provided for these runs of fish that we're having right now. And one other thing I just want to say is that I heard testimony at a conference that 40% of the power costs for BPA are directly attributable to environmental restrictions or conservation efforts. And I was wondering if that's true, because if that is true, the poor are being disproportionately affected in their, as to Representative Widener's comment, in what they have to pay for their electricity as a part of their income. So, I mean, I think we really, really need to review how this is affecting the poor and poverty-stricken, if that number is true, 40% of the cost.
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt, I'm not sure about the number. I can get you more information.
Great.
I know that we have done that before, and I will send it to you and the committee.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, just one very quick comment on that. The member of the staff mentioned to me something I didn't realize. The number I heard was about one-third of the cost. That'd be in line with 40%. The other thing is that the hangover from whoops is also one-third. The mistakes made by poor planning contribute to the same cost. And the further information is that even at 3 cents a kilowatt hour, our wholesale power costs, we are some of the lowest in the nation. We still have a very good deal, but that's no excuse for wasting money.
Right.
At least they got the acronym right.
Yeah.
Well, we appreciate your time, and thank you for making the trip to present before us. It's extremely helpful as we set the context for our future discussions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
With that, we'll close the informational hearing on Bonneville Power Administration, Northwest Power Conservation Council. Open an informational hearing on smart grid and demand response. Call up Lee Hall and Wayne Lay, please. And colleagues, this is a part of our continuing series of important contextual concepts that I think will shape the future of energy in this state. And although perhaps more specific than our last overview, I think a very important overview, nonetheless, of what's happening.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I am Lee Hall, the Smart Grid and Demand Response Program Manager at Bonneville Power, located in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you. I'll be happy to answer any of your questions. My discussion today is about the Smart Grid and Demand Response Programs at Bonneville Power. And just to start out, there's a large, important part of the Smart Grid and Demand Response program that is located here in Oregon in the collaboration with public power utilities, and I'll be talking a lot about those as we go through the presentation. First of all, the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid Demonstration Project is a result of the ARRA funding that came out of the 2009 federal legislation. It is actually the largest smart grid demonstration project in the country. We're very proud of that. It's $178 million with half funded by the utility and industry and BPA partners, and $89 million that are provided by DOE funds. It's a five-year demonstration. We are in year four, actually moving up into year five. And as such, it's a 60,000 meter customers in five states, the four-state Northwest region, as well as Western Wyoming and Jackson Hole. And again, the importance of this is the geographic diversity, the diversity among utilities involving both investor-owned utilities and consumer-owned utilities, small utilities, large utilities, and a vast array of smart grid type of equipment and technology, including smart meters, electric car chargers, voltage regulation, a wide array of systems that we are testing. The reason, and these are really the four main reasons and the goals of the project, are to quantify costs and benefits. And we've heard already a lot of discussion about the costs and benefits and the cost effectiveness of solutions. We want to develop a communications protocol because one of the keys of smart grid is two-way communications, along with automation, along with good decision, automated decision-making processes. But developing this two-way communications protocol, and this is a breakthrough type of research and development that we want to test in this project. Developing standards around cybersecurity and interoperability. Cybersecurity is a very important topic in the utility industry, but also interoperability so that systems can talk to systems easily. And when you're talking about automation and two-way communications, this is an important part of our effort. And of course, to facilitate integration of wind and other renewables with a concentration on wind because of a large concentration of wind in the Pacific Northwest, especially in the Mid-Columbia Plateau. Again, as I said, it's led by Battelle Lab, which operates the Pacific Northwest National Lab in Richland, Washington, BPA 11 utilities, two universities who are located in the state of Washington. They compete with each other. That's Washington State and University of Washington, and five major vendors, including IBM and Alstom Grid, which are very big in the energy industry. This is just a little bit of a highlight film around the region. I won't go through everybody, but it's again, highlights the geographic diversity and the diversity of assets. I'll talk about the two specific in the state of Oregon. Milton Freewater, City of Milton Freewater, has actually been a leader in demand response to smart grid for 25 years. And who would have thought that a small town with 5,000 customers would do that? They've had great vision. They saw the reasons for going into demand response, which is really about shifting load or reducing load during peak times. And they've gotten economic benefit, which they then in turn passed on to their ratepayers, to their customers. They've now gone to the next step of advancing that in their area, in their city, and they have also connected via this two-way communication signal that stretches across the Pacific Northwest, these 11 utilities. And Portland General Electric, my colleague Wayne Lee will talk more about that, but I'd like to highlight right here in Salem, the 5-megawatt battery, which they have installed, a 5-megawatt lithium-ion battery, if I'm not mistaken, which is the largest installation of a major or large storage electric battery in the Pacific Northwest. That's pretty neat. And they've taken he'll go in a lot more detail about that, but I'd like to say that we're very proud of that installation, and it's been recognized in articles around the country. Again, talking about the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid Demonstration Project, an important part of this is the business case, to validate new smart grid technologies and inform business cases, cost-benefit analyses, so utilities themselves can decide, does it make sense from an ROI and a return on investment or time to recoup the investment, making informed decisions to optimize their investments. And that's a major project, part of the project for BPA, to pass on that information to our customer utilities so they can make good decisions about investing in this new technology. And utility installations will leave behind about $100 million of installed equipment that will be used and useful by utilities to benefit their customers and benefit the utilities. And again, these example technologies include everything from thermostats, electric water heater controllers, energy management systems in homes, electric vehicle chargers, smart appliances that can actually take a signal and operate based on that signal, distributed generation, small wind, small solar, of course, from a distribution standpoint, outage management, automated capacity banks, how to manage better at the distribution level, the distribution of energy. And then also from a transmission or larger transmission standpoint, transmission sensors on the system that provide real-time information about the operation system and can mitigate the possibility of large-scale outages. Other things, which is central storage, and I've talked about batteries, two-way communications infrastructure, and this idea of transactive control, which is a two-way communication, which sends a signal and says, here's the price signal I would like to send you, and the signal that comes back says, this is how I can respond to that price signal or some monetized signal. And this transactive energy concept is gaining a lot of ground in the country. So now I'm going to shift a little bit over to demand response. And demand response we consider to be somewhat of a subset of smart grid in general, but it's an important part of energy management in that the, again, demand response is very specifically designed for two things. One's for economic dispatch, that is, can I reduce load during a certain time when there's high energy prices, or shift load to a time where there's lower energy prices? That's the economic standpoint. From a liability standpoint, it would be, can I reduce load so it reduces the load on my system, on the generators and on the transmission system? So there's really two major drivers, economic and reliability, and to some extent they're very interrelated. This picture shows that in the across the country, there are large programs for demand response, again, shifting load or reducing load during peak times, that have approached now 10% of that peak load and have been an important energy management part of ISOs, TVA, RTOs around the country, transmission or areas. About 80,000 megawatts of this controllable load in the United States, and that's a big number. That's that controllable load that you can call on it, whether it's electric water heater load or industrial load or commercial load, at a certain time, particularly around peak times in the summertime. And again, the rest of the country is concentrated on that peak load during summertime, late afternoon and summertime, where they need to reduce load. Otherwise, they have voltage and frequency problems on the system. The picture as the on the lower right, you see there, so it's a couple of green and red lines that are more or less base load. And then the blue line shows the signal that came in and dropped the load during a specific time of peak use of electricity. And this is again the traditional use of demand response to reduce peak load, reduce load during peaks, so you don't put such a strain on generation and on transmission, and I'll also say on the distribution systems at the local utilities. This has been come to be known as demand response 1.0. I'm going to contrast that to demand response 2.0, where other uses for demand response are emerging. First, a little bit about the regional drivers that we are developing, and just for discussion, we have had a demand response and smart grid program at Bonneville Power for the last 3.5 or 4 years. We have evolved from this peak demand, serving specifically utilities, to thinking about demand response and energy storage is how do we best use it to balance the grid, help integrate renewables, and these are some of these drivers that now we've developed. A couple of pictures on the right, which is a couple of projections on the cumulative northwest wind generation. We've had a lot of discussion about that already. There are different scenarios, but even if in the middle scenario, we anticipate more wind coming on the system, and again, it's concentrated in BPA's service territory in the Mid-Columbia region, which we serve with our transmission. And just by background, we also showed, it's kind of hard to see, this on the lower right is a graph, and this is real data. It goes from 1,000 megawatts of increased load increased generation to 1,000 megawatts of decreased generation. This is the balancing, real-time balancing that the Columbia River needs to do via the 31 projects in response to changes in load and changes in variable generation, essentially wind. How's the wind ramp up and down? And you've heard a lot about, or a certain amount about the limitations on the Columbia River generating Columbia River power system, essentially the dams, to be able to respond in this capacity. And these are the limits that we see, and we're within the limits in these cases, but we'd like to think of demand response as being part of this. Again, the Columbia River power system is responding in this way. That's why this graph is moving up and down. That's the response, the variability in its against base generation. If we could squeeze down that available generation, it would be available for other purposes, marketing or serving base load, and it could also it would also be more reliable, if you will. And that's why we're thinking about demand response. Essentially, we're talking about a paradigm shift. Instead of building and operating generation always to meet exactly what the load is, be thinking now about the generation load balance. Can we also operate load to respond to what the generation is doing? And that's a paradigm shift in the industry, quite honestly. So for wind integration, you've heard about our balancing reserve demands, which the picture on the lower right graphically shows that. And we don't have a lot of geographic diversity, which helps other wind or balancing authorities across the country. We don't, so it's either more or less all turned on or all turned off, more or less. Of course, the river management, we've talked about this balancing reserves, ease supply constraints in general, because we are really becoming energy rich with renewables coming online, but capacity poor, capacity being the ability to respond with energy when you need it. Transmission expansion challenges, of course. We like to think if we can reduce load at the end of a line, that it would reduce the need for building or reinforcing transmission, which is very expensive. And again, those costs can get passed to our customers. And of course, the economic benefits to local utilities, helping with their, we do the an economic signal to our customer utilities, send a demand charge to address their peak to help us manage our costs around serving that peak load. So if they're able to reduce their peak demand, they reduce their demand charge, and there's benefit to everybody, benefit to their ratepayers, benefit to BPA on behalf of all our preference customers. And then not only that, but help them reduce their need for extra substations, distribution lines, and so on. So we think there's a very strong economic model. We're testing that model through a lot of pilots. Again, I talked about this move to demand response 2.0, going from traditional peak load management, but also using end loads to meet emerging regional needs. And we've tested a lot of systems at the end load, public buildings, heating and cooling systems, cold storage warehouses, and the picture in the middle is one from Albany, the Snow Temp cold storage facility. Electric water heaters, we think, is a great resource as multiple mini batteries, if you will. But how can we use them to store energy and then to draw energy, if you will, or not have to charge them up? Industrial loads, we think, are very positive or promising opportunity because they're big loads. They're in the tens of megawatts. Large farm water management, some small-scale batteries, and some aquifer recharge. We tested this load in the lower right-hand corner, just charging up an aquifer aquifer in southeast Idaho. It was a pilot project just to show whether we could actually do it. When wind is blowing, we'd send the power to there. Now, that's the concept. There's a lot of power there, less than 2 megawatts, which is just a little bit of just kind of a blip on the system. But how do we prove that and show that we can do that at a larger scale? So we think that demand response is a cost-effective and green alternative, and again, cost matter, because cost-effective compared to the next best alternative, which oftentimes is a gas-powered turbine. The next slide is a little bit of an eye chart, and I apologize for that. Some of the takeaways from this are there are Oregon utilities that have really, we've had tremendous collaboration with. I've already mentioned the City of Milton Freewater, but Central Electric in Redmond, City of Forest Grove, Emerald PUD near Eugene Water Electric Board, and Consumers Power based in Philomath. These have all been utilities that have stepped up to do these pilot programs, to test the technologies, and they're all lining up for the next stage, which I'll talk about a little bit later, to move from piloting and proof of concept to now how do we commercialize and make it actually dispatchable, that we could depend on this at scale and actually use it to help balance the system. Eugene Water Electricity Board, for example, has a, this is actually a combination energy efficiency and demand response pilot with a wastewater treatment operated by the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission. We want to see if we can act as a dispatchable large-scale utility DR resource greater than 1 megawatt. And again, water management is a great opportunity, we think, throughout the Pacific Northwest. City water systems, wastewater treatment, irrigation pumps are a huge load on the system at any and various times. And the purpose of this pilot is to measure and verify that performance, and can we call on this, given certain constraints, as a load that we can move. Another aspect of the DR 2.0 is not only reducing load, but how can we sometimes increase load in response to the system? Recall in that balancing equation, there were sometimes we needed to actually increase generation and decrease generation. Well, if we actually increase load, it'd be the same thing as decreasing generation. So it's equivalent, and that's the terminology we talk about. So, and that's another part of DR 2.0. How can you, for example, when the wind blows, and this is a simplistic example, when you don't expect it to, it comes on the system, can you charge up and increase the temperature on thousands of electric water heaters or industrial loads that they can kick in, or a little bit of pre-cooling in a cold storage warehouse? And we're testing all these types of concepts. And that's not the entire focus, but we've tested them and actually have gotten a national award for this kind of groundbreaking proof of concept testing. So last slide I'd like to go through before turning it over to Wayne is this two-pronged approach that we are continuing to do in demand response. The first prong, which we've done for 4 years, is continuing to do research and development through the BPA Technology Innovation Program. And one of those projects, for example, is that EWEP project, and we're talking about how to test a new technology at the end load and how controllable it could be in buildings, more electric water heat, and different control schemes, how best to optimize that. But the second prong, which we think is really the timely piece, is DR advanced demonstrations that we take what we know and now turn 1 or 2 or 3 megawatt projects into tens of megawatts, make it scalable, put a commercial contract in place that have terms and conditions for its use, which are very similar to those in other parts of the country, and then be able to show our transmission and power operators that it can actually operate in response to the system. That's the next phase, and we're doing it in an incremental way to show the technical feasibility, the commercial feasibility, and also that it's cost-effective, as I said, vis-a-vis the next best alternative. And we're always concerned about that. But in conclusion, we believe that we're moving forward with this, developing as a resource, not the only resource, if you will, or not the only opportunity we have to help balance the system and help our customer utilities balance their load. We think this will be cost effective, and we're in the process of developing now at scale to show that and to develop those resources in the region. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate the presentation. Mr. Lay.
Well, Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm really happy to be here and have an opportunity to provide some examples, actually, for what Lee has actually just done a really nice overview for. I'm Wayne Lay, and I do some corporate research and development for Portland General Electric. So just to get right into it, this is a traditional power grid right here. It's pretty much one-way movement of power. You have a power plant, big, thick transmission lines. You get some medium ones once you get to a substation. And then from there out to feeder lines, a feeder line that's kind of medium, and then some other lines that come off those that actually hook up to your home and small business schools. This is a system that's built that is what is called kind of a low power factor. We actually overbuild it so that we can handle huge amounts of call on that power whenever you need it, usually during a very hot day or a very cold day. But most of the time, it's just hanging out at a very low level. And so it's a system that was designed largely for one-way movement. You don't really insert things into it to move power back and forth, nor do you have integrated capabilities to communicate. These are really difficult things to do, actually. So this is kind of a smart grid vision, one particular vision that you could have, where, in point of fact, with lots of advances in technology, the ability to put you know, to do really powerful computing on small chips, you actually have the ability now, and we're seeing this penetrating our grid at Portland General Electric, the fact that you can have photovoltaic solar panels on houses, on large ones, on top of warehouses, even small wind turbines at very high up where the wind is really quite good. There's an example of that in Portland. You have scale. That's interesting here, because this is a relatively small scale, so you can get relatively small batteries, which actually will probably cross the line in cost effectiveness before the really big batteries will. So you see here the possibility of a plug-in electric hybrid, which has a very competent battery and a lithium-ion battery. There is actually no reason why, at the end of the day, you know, barring some hard work, these kinds of things cannot actually be a part of the grid. And so these are the kinds of things that a smart grid actually starts to look at. At the end of the day, too, it will require lots of data management and communication management. And so our advanced meters that we have installed at Portland General Electric will help with that. But I don't want to kid anybody here, too. There is one line that goes back out to the utility, and the utility is continued to be leaned on here as the backup as we move into this pretty exciting future. So this is kind of the way the grid actually looks. If you just look at characteristics, we're very electromechanical. You know, just lots of things go click, and you have metals, and you have contacts that are very mechanical. More into the future, you still will have a solid click, but driven by a digital signal. We'll be moving closer to two-way communication. You're starting to see that now. Lee just gave some examples of it. We will have more distributed generation, not just the central power model. All this will require network controls. There will be sensors that will be placed on lines, even down to the feeder line, that will monitor the power system in both directions very frequently and with timestamps, so that you can get frequency of, you know, whether or not the problem you can see a problem and at what time, and you know, if you're really good at that problem you saw maybe 2 weeks earlier, and you know what, that didn't end up in a pretty good result, so let's isolate that portion of the grid. That makes the grid more resilient. You can see applications for that in response to big storms, for instance, and you can even proactively shut down parts of the system then to help preserve it and then bring it back on later. So these are the kinds of things that you'd see in a smarter grid. It's going to be evolutionary, not revolutionary, really. If you go to Home Depot now, you can get a little device plug into your outlet. It'll communicate. You can plug a lamp into that. You can plug a heater into it. You can view what that one outlet will do through your smartphone and control it. That's kind of a bit of the future there. So at PGE, we have done a number of things. We've installed very successfully 825,000 smart meters. These are meters that will now tell us precisely the condition of our connection to the home, to the service drop. We no longer have to have anybody call us about, hey, you know, I don't have any power here. We have done some remarkable work with a bunch of partners at the Salem Smart Power Project. And then we've continued to upgrade our own system here a little bit more incrementally through what is called SCADA project, which is our substations that you saw back there actually are fairly intelligent even now. And we continue a program to continue to install that level of intelligence into our substations. We have other outlooks into the future for technology. And then finally, we have a very unique program here at Portland General Electric. It's called Dispatchable Standby Generation. I'll explain that a little bit more of a bit of a picture, but we are the only utility in the United States, and as far as I know, on the planet that actually has this program. So, and it's really quite remarkable. So, just to tell you a little bit more about the Salem Smart Power Project, you go back on mission out here, head out of town. turn right on 22nd. I don't actually have a picture of the outside building here, but we haven't won any national awards or anything like that, but I can assure you it's a brown building, and that's the only 5-megawatt lithium-ion battery that has landscaping around it, so it'll be hard to miss. It is 5-megawatt of battery. It is 1.25-megawatt hour of energy storage. This is a large battery. The next largest battery east of Salem, Oregon, of this type of design, lithium-ion electrochemistry, you have to go to West Virginia. So these things are truly few and far in between. We can do a number of things with this, and we actually have 5 assets that come into play as part of the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid demonstration. The first of these is the fact that it's a pretty slick battery. Lithium-ion has high power density and high energy density, and that's why you go for it. It's pretty unique in terms of its electrochemistry in that way. We can hook up to our dispatchable standby generation system. There are actually 3 of these out there, and we can actually go into a microgrid mode and isolate entirely from the system. One of the characteristics that you may have noticed from moving from the tradition to the future is the ability to island. And if you're on the East Coast, this is becoming much, much more of a prevalent discussion because, well, their systems have been flattened at least, well, let's say 4 times in the last 6 years. That's pretty profound. And so the ability then to isolate out and you get off the grid or provide your own power is starting to be looked at in this concept, and we actually have an example of it here in Salem. The demand response I won't go into in great detail because Lee did, but we do have the ability to respond to a signal from Battelle up in the Tri-Cities and actually turn off some water heaters, which is pretty slick. That's residential, and then we also have the ability then to actually be a part of this transactive operation where a price signal will drive automated way the use of these assets. So about 4 days ago, this is the first, a price signal was generated in Richland, Washington. Just by virtue of monitoring the market, it connected into our system, drove all the way down itself, all the way down to Salem, and discharged our battery. And there was not a single hand that actually hit anything to do that. That's very impressive, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
It's also a little scary, actually, to be honest with you. But nonetheless, it's quite doable.
Skynet has come online.
You may wonder how you can park a lithium-ion battery of this size in a kind of a light industrial residential neighborhood. And a lot of that has to do with a great relationship we have with our communities, I think, and some really great attention to detail. This is serial number 1 for Portland General Electric, maybe serial number 3 for the United States. And so what you see up there on those red cans is actually a pressurized gas that will pressurize a little red tube that winds itself around our battery racks here. And if you encounter a flame in this battery, that tube will rupture and discharge that tank and fully discharge that tank. We have put extraordinary fire control. We have toured every shift of the local fire station through this, so we're being very, very careful with serial number 1. So a couple others. We have an automated demand response program ourselves that has been in response to a request from the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Currently, we have 8 customers enrolled. We're targeting right now about 3 megawatts. So this is a pretty big deal. And what it is during really hot days, during really cold days, the ability then to move power on and off automated is what this project will demonstrate. And so far, we're very, very happy with it. It's the ability to do lighting reductions, HVAC, the ability to have refrigeration and heating reduced just for short periods of time, and that's enough to do that. This is the distributed standby generation program right here. This is a very unique program. This slide's actually almost out of date now. We've been moving toward 100 megawatts of this type of generation. These are backup generators that you'll find at hospitals, at critical buildings. And what we do is we go in and we talk with these owners and we say, hey, look, we'll take care of this thing for you. We really will. We'll service it. We'll maintain it. We'll run it. But here's the deal. If you allow us to do this, we will fire up these things during really high peak periods, hot, cold days. And power is usually quite expensive during that time. We'll even divvy up the proceeds with you. So what turns out to be essentially a sunk cost for us, and now in because these have already been paid for by those facilities, now actually has another use. And this is a very unique program. We can dispatch these by automated controls at the World Trade Center in Portland, Oregon, and we are now hitting about 100 megawatts. And this would be 100 megawatts of that type of capacity response that would not have to be built to do that. It's very efficient. So the ability to have our customers know a lot more about their energy and then make decisions about how to use it through our energy tracking program. And so just to conclude, this is the control panel at the Salem Smart Power Center. Just this brown building over here on 22nd. We have stuff hanging off of plywood boards, it looks kind of rude, but it's efficient, I assure you. This is highly reminiscent of the Apple I computer back in 1976. And arguably, 35 years later, it kind of looks like this, And so what I really wanted to drive home here in this conclusion is, even something off to the left will look maybe something like this 35 years into the future. And so that's the kind of future I think we can have to look forward to. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a fascinating couple of presentations, and congratulations on your recent achievements. Those are dramatic. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon?
Yeah, thank you so much. I love your presentation and the future you're presenting to us. At some point, I'd like to know more, and not necessarily today, but at some point about the economic impacts of all of this good stuff on, say, the utilities, or from an investor standpoint, from a customer standpoint, there's going to be some costs and probably some cost shifts. So maybe all the excitement, what's going on there? So.
Representative Reardon, we'd be delighted to do that. And I'll tell you right now, these are all demonstration programs at this point, but they are very cutting edge. And so the pricing will come along with that. We are actually in the midst of trying to assess a fair amount of that even now. It's pretty early on, though. Even some of these programs I mentioned earlier, we're the only ones doing some of these. BPA is the only one doing some of these. So we don't have the power of numbers or motivation behind that at this point, but we will. When we have, we're at that point, we'd be delighted to come back here and share that.
I would have, Representative Vega Peterson.
Okay. Well, I just had two quick questions. One was, I think thank you very much for coming. And then what you said about the power being able to change the system without anybody's hand touching it. I think that really underlines the importance of cybersecurity in generating these things. And so I'd love to have some more information about that, because I think that's, right along, got to be one of the top priorities as far as creating these systems, too.
Representative Peterson, absolutely. I mean, in fact, I dare say that, and I think Lee would reinforce this, the hardest thing to do here is actually the communications and the controls.
Mm-hmm.
I can show you a picture of a battery that Professor Volta built in 220 years ago. It looks remarkably similar to this, these guys here, to be honest. But those controls, the most difficult thing you actually have to do is actually penetrate the firewalls that we put up to protect our own systems. It's very difficult to do. And so that's a very excellent observation. And so we only allow the one tunnel, and it's very, very closely guarded to do that. But that will be reproduced en masse over the years if we get more of this type of automation.
Yeah. And then we'll follow up.
Please.
And then the other thing that struck me was just, we've talked a little bit about energy efficiencies and where we can do that. And I'm curious if you're doing any work right now in the smart appliances or the smart devices on the end user, and have any projects going on with that.
We do, but I think Lee ought to maybe address it first, because actually they've taken quite a lead on this.
Well, Chair Bailey and Representative Peterson, we have. not necessarily with projects here in Oregon, but as part of the Smart Grid Demonstration Project, we have Flathead Electric, which is in northwest Montana, has a break, I think, a cutting-edge technology project that was partially funded by the federal government, but also a partner was General Electric, where they went to 100 homes and at a reduced price offered a suite of energy-efficient and demand response or smart grid-capable appliances, all the way from major appliances, dryers, washers, dishwashers, and so on. And for a discounted price, the quid pro quo was me, the consumer, will allow the utility to operate these within some certain parameters. So they're both energy efficient, Energy Star appliances that have, as for a small add-on, if you will, or small appliance add-on, this is one of the issues about standards. Can we make this plug and play to make it the barriers to entry for all parties, make it available, make it easier to install these. Nonetheless, we're testing this, and the test results need to come in. Another part of this, which we really haven't talked about, if I may, is the consumer acceptance of smart grid demand response. Because at the end of the day, the consumer, whether the consumer's in the home, or the commercial business industry, or a farmer, needs to have some incentive potentially, and the marketing and so on, to see some value in that value chain. And that's been a large part of our thinking too. How do we, through BPA's customer utilities, get to their customers and enroll them, how to help those utilities enroll them, and so that there's potentially an economic incentive, because we think these products, if you will, or this ability to change load has value in the system. Again, value vis-a-vis the next most cost-effective resource. So that's an important part. And another part that we worry a little bit about is, so I'm kind of diverting the question, but is consumer fatigue, if you will. That, for example, in Flathead Electric, we can't just send the signal daily, hourly, to change the device. How long will the consumer themselves bear with it, and how much can they tolerate, and do they have an override function? Yes, they do. So those are considerations when you get to the actual consumer acceptance of either air conditioning load or any kind of heating load, even to make sure that that electric water heat is there when they need it, hot water. And in fact, I'm pleased to say, out of 1,200 installations that we've done through these automated controls of electric water heat, we've had zero complaints, and some built-in automation to make sure we don't have any complaints. So that's an important aspect. We can't forget about the consumer and the value to the consumer, not only to keep them warm and healthy and happy in their home or business, but also, is there a potential economic benefit to them in terms of a revenue flow?
You can go to Lowe's right now and get a water heater that'll have a socket that you can plug a chip into. And so we've had a gentleman by the name of Conrad Kroskoff, has that PG, that has participated very significantly in committees then to identify what this chip will do. But largely it is to communicate with either our system or with a third party system to actually provide that type of demand response. You can hold a lot of energy in a big tank of water. And so the notion is that, you know, for a couple hours you decrease the temperature a little or even increase it, the tank can handle it. The consumer probably won't notice it. And when you want to divert that power is when the power is most expensive anyway. So there's actually an economic incentive to do that, and you can actually share the goods with folks and make it kind of rational in that respect.
Thank you. Sam Benson? Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Very much appreciate your time. It's fascinating. We look forward to future developments on it. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Okay, with that, we will close the informational meeting on Smart Grid and adjourn the meeting.